Your daughter has arrived just in time to witness a practical demonstration of our powers of persuasion. Are you so foolish as to believe that you can oppose the will of Fu Manchu?
This is Bristol. It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock, and welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on the 19th of January 2024, streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft in Bristol on the radio.org.uk stream, at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores. And if you've got your Google Play on your Android phone, get rid of it now, throw it in the bin. Disable it, delete it, whatever you have to do, and get something rather nice called Aurora, which is just like Google Play, and it's got all the stuff on it that Google stops people having on their Android phones in their fascistic, control freak, not evil fashion. So I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting it with its military grade propaganda, the puppet pieces on the conspirators and the hatchet jobs on the heroes, and the McCarthyite witch hunts going after anyone with influence, actually killing many of them, including David Amos MP, who speaks up for humanity and against World War III and wage slavery. So for those with eyes to see and ears to hear, these so-called solutions to every crisis, whether it's Gaza, Ukraine, COVID, migrants, we'll be hearing about that, and Rwanda tonight, the cost of living, climate, twisted accelerationist Armageddonist policy designed to make every crisis worse. And the politicians, as Manfred Petrich would say, have nothing to say. So Huxley's diabolical plan rewards only blind obedience. Meanwhile, pantheistic wife murdering wet king tampon Charlie in Davos, I don't actually even know if he's allowed over there because it's such a political thing at the moment, wages war on the British people as well as on China, Russia and the Houthis too now, and the BRICS, aided by regime change, referendum failure, Diddy David Cameron. So helping us navigate the West's fourth industrial revolution and the fourth right matrix, it's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. This week we'll be taking a good look at Palestine action. In a way, the sort of heroes of the week, I think, after that brief blip on Monday morning with the arrest of people who actually were only planning to chain themselves to the gates of the stock exchange or some such thing to do a protest about genocide, which of course is everyone's duty really to stop genocide, apart from, it seems, the Daily Express and the Metropolitan Police, who dubbed them in. And it was fascinating to listen to the bulletins on Monday this week, where the announcement that there'd been, I think it was 6 arrests for of Palestine Action people, they immediately said on the next part of the bulletin, the stock exchange doesn't run from here anymore. It's all run remotely. So they couldn't shut it down anyway. So the idea they've been arrested for attempting to shut it down is a bit of a joke, right from the word go. So that the one person who's finally been arrested probably will be either, if they are tried, will be acquitted. So we shall see. And a lot about Palestine action tonight. We also hopefully be being joined in an hour or so by Ron Mandel from Bristol Palestine Solidarity. We'll be also going to Dubai to hear an interview I did, a part of it anyway, I did earlier on today with Dr. Judith Brown, who's our resident Yemen expert. She's been working in Yemen for many years, to talk about this attack. Martin, maybe we could just start. I thought it was extraordinary on BBC Question Time this week to hear about half an hour devoted to Rwanda, another bit to is Donald Trump's election going to destroy the world, something else about is it evil to eat meat, but nothing about declaring war on Yemen or the genocide going on in Gaza.
Well, it's what Brian Eno years ago called propaganda, which means that the things that you're supposed to care about are presented to you. This is the important stuff. And of course, what's going on in Gaza, well, that's just minor. You don't really need to pay attention to it. I mean, that's how these things are done.
There's an extent to which, isn't it, that, now there's only 1,000 people every couple of days being bombed in this genocide. It's no longer news.
Well, that's right, because what the Israelis are hoping for is that people will just, you know, that other things will come along. And, of course, they generally do, because it's the world's in a bit of a bad state. But, there's a very conscious attempt to manage public opinion going on here. It's very heavy-handed. And, of course, one of the things is simply to ignore what's going on. That's good enough from a point of view of the Israelis. If everybody just ignores it, that suits them.
So I thought maybe we could start with one of our clips about the... about the Rwanda policy. Can you just let us know what you make of it, Martin? I mean, I've always thought from the start this is a very strange thing to be doing, to be outsourcing your dealing with asylum claims to a country over in Africa somewhere.
Well, that's right. I mean, the whole thing has just gradually built itself up from a tiny kind of idea into this monstrous thing that where the Tory party is tearing itself apart about it. Even if they manage to get a few hundred asylum seekers to Rwanda, there's no work for them in Rwanda, so we'd have to just pay for them to be there permanently, so it's hugely expensive. And, of course, it does nothing at all to deal with the fundamental problem, which is you've got lots more people coming, and the asylum system, they're not processing. They need to process the asylum claims that they've already got. They don't want to do that because the whole ideology behind this is if we make it really, really, really difficult to come to Britain, people won't come. That is simply wrong. The world is in turmoil. People are going to come. You've got to have a policy rather than saying, well, make them all go away. And, of course, that's not done. They're not going to go away, and you've got to have a policy. And the policy of sending them to Rwanda simply doesn't solve the problem and in any way, shape or form. It's just performative, symbolic nonsense.
Well, one of the classic bits of accelerationism was the idea of rolling out an experimental vaccine in order to sort out COVID. The idea is really that the cure is worse than a disease. So experimenting on billions of people around the world doesn't seem to necessarily be a good idea because some of them may die, and obviously some of them have, because of these experiments. But I wonder whether you would agree with me that Rwanda is you can also directly stick a little label on this as accelerationism, because it's almost as if they're fighting over whether to do it or not, but or how to do it. But actually the whole idea is a disaster from the beginning.
That's right, it's a silly idea from the get-go. But it's become a big deal in the Tory party because Suella Braverman saw it as a way to undermine Rishi Sunak and end up as being the Tory leader and, God forbid, Prime Minister. And that's all that's on their minds. This is very much an argument amongst the Tories. Nobody else cares about it.
When the Tories lose the next election, she may become Tory leader.
Well, that's right. That's what she wants. And that's the position the Tory party is in now. They're actually all manoeuvring for what happens after they lose. But, of course, that means that they're really interested in the 80,000 Tory membership. And the Tory membership are all in favour of sending people to Rwanda because they're mostly elderly and they're not very bright.
Yeah, I'd agree with you, yeah. Anyway, I thought we'd have a little listen to... I've got three clips on Rwanda. One is from Jacob Rees-Mogg, one is from Nigel Farage, and another one is from this amazing lawyer on last night's BBC Question Time, who just spelt it all out for them in very, very clear, plain terms. I think the BBC's message is that maybe they should let lawyers, corporate lawyers, rule the country, because nobody else on the panel had a clue, including the Telegraph journalists on there. And this lawyer just spelt it out for us. And I guess that's because the circles that they move in, the inner temple types, in central London, do discuss all these things. And Parliament, in a way, although they're making the laws, Martin, they're not implementing them. They don't necessarily know anything about them. Someone like Suella Braverman has put herself behind this policy that was never going to work.
Well, I think it's more to do with the performative nature of the politics. You've got to be seen to be doing something. And they're getting increasingly desperate because they've not got a, lots of the asylum seekers are already here, but they've got to find accommodation for them because they haven't processed their claims. If they processed their claims, they could work. Many of them are quite highly skilled. They could just work. There's plenty of them who are doctors and nurses, for example. But of course, they've got themselves in this knot because they just want it all to go away, and they promised their core electorate, including the 80,000 members of the party, that this was what they were going to do and they were going to sort it out. But it's a problem that's actually bigger than the Tory party. It's bigger than Great Britain. It's bigger than Europe. It's a massive problem all over the world.
Now, I'm sure it's your favourite programme too, Martin. It's on Wednesday nights, the Robert Peston Show. Good old Jacob Rees-Mogg was on there this week. And let's have a listen now to him talking about what he thinks about Rwanda.
A little earlier on, I had a chat with a former minister, the Tory MP Jacob Rees-Mogg. And I began by asking him, because this was after that vote for, you know, Rishi Sunak's Safety of Rwanda bill, and in, you know, the debates and the earlier voting, Rees-Mogg had made it clear he wasn't really in favour of it. So why in the end did he vote for a bill that he thinks, as I was saying to Farage earlier, Jacob Rees-Mogg thinks is inadequate?
Because you shouldn't let the best be the enemy of the good. That one very often votes for bills that one thinks could be better in one way or another. But this bill is better than the status quo. Could it have been better still? Yes. But the bill that was in front of us is better than the current situation.
Do you have any confidence that it will lead to any serious number of asylum seekers being expelled to Rwanda?
I think the issue is time rather than effect. I think the amendments that I was supporting would have sped up the process. And I think this bill, over a year or 2 years, would prove effective. Without the amendments, it's unlikely to prove effective, in my view, in the time available before a general election. But I'd be delighted to be proved wrong.
So what do you think when someone like Robert Jenrick says that you're letting your core voters down?
Well, I mean, Robert knows the bill very well. He obviously was a Home Office minister. I think the issue we may well face is this being an election issue. The Labour Party, the Lib Dems, the SNP are really against any serious migration policy. They seem to want to have pretty much open borders. And it's only the Conservatives who have a way forward. Now, it will be disappointing if the way forward hasn't led to action happening before the election, but at least there's an indication of where we're going, whereas the others have no clue where they're going.
Well, one of the suggestions I've heard recently is taking action against these gangs through the French courts, which is one possibility. There's all sorts of other ways that these boats could be deterred by one means or another. But Martin, the long and short of it is Rees-Mogg is saying, well, it's not perfect, but, you know, this is going to possibly help us win this election because this is going to be a major election issue this year.
Well, the Tory party thinks it is. Whether it is or not, I'm not quite sure. If you look at what people say they care about, it's things like the NHS and the cost of living crisis. But let's just put that aside. This is an internal fight within the Tory party. What the right wing of the Tory party were hoping that they would have enough votes to shoot down this bill and therefore undermine Sunak and therefore get their own people in. But Rees-Mogg, of course, doesn't really aspire to be Prime Minister anymore, so he's now thinking in terms of how can we just, you know, steady the ship here. At the same time as we're going to war with Yemen, creating more refugees, and of course a war that we've been involved with for over a decade. We've been helping the Saudis to bomb Yemen, and of course that sort of thing does create a few refugees. And, of course, that's just totally missing from this discussion, isn't it?
Yeah, it certainly is. Yeah, so let's have a listen now to BBC Question Time with the lawyer who's introduced right at the very... I put the little bit from the start of the show where the Antiques Roadshow girl introduces everybody, and so you can see get an idea of who he is, but he just completely wipes the floor with everybody else.
By his own admission, Hashim Mohammed went to some of the worst schools in the country and was raised on state benefits. That was after arriving here at the age of 9 as an unaccompanied child refugee. Now he's a successful barrister, presents radio documentaries, and has written 2 books, one about social mobility, the other about housing.
The question talked about whether it will work. It won't.
What he's saying is, worth it, is it worth the proposal?
Is it worth it? We know it's not worth it. You know it's not worth it. I'm sure Bim really deep down in his heart knows it's not worth it. And yet, let's think about what's happening right now. First things first, it's important to acknowledge that people are really concerned about the boats crossings and so many people are dying and something has to be done. I think any rational person agrees on that level. 2 years ago, I travelled to Dresden, the German town, and I met an Eritrean man who had been deported from Israel to Rwanda. He'd been paid to go to Rwanda. Rwanda had a reciprocal arrangement with Israel to take refugees. When he got there, the Rwandans said, "You don't need to stay. There's the door." And he used the money that he was given to make his way back that treacherous journey, and he made his way to Dresden, where he sought asylum again. The Supreme Court in Israel struck down that law. And when we got to our Supreme Court, there's a passage by our learned judges where they said the Home Office hadn't even assessed the Israel-Rwanda policy before they decided to adopt it. So we know it's not going to work. It's unviable. It's expensive. And the only person it's working for is the Rwandans, because they won't give us a penny back. And what we're seeing right now, instead of them actually dealing with this properly and actually having some real ideas, do you know what they're doing? They're attacking our judges. They're attacking our rule of law. They are dividing a society. They are making us feel like refugees are the scum and who are foreign. They refer to the European courts that we are a part of that have United Kingdom judges as foreign courts. It's not only just disgusting, as this young lady was saying, it's unconscionable. The rhetoric is poison, and we have to acknowledge that. And absolutely, I end where I started, which is this is an issue that we need to grapple with. The gentleman talked about the French authorities. The French authorities have offered for us to station ourselves over there, provided we pay. Imagine how much we could have used for that £400,000 on that side of the channel.
£400 million,
I beg your pardon, for us to be on that side of the channel to monitor it. Instead, this week, with everything that's happening in the world, everything that's happening in this country, this week our Prime Minister spent his precious time dealing with the loonies in his parties. It's unconscionable.
Okay. So...
yeah, so fascinating chap. So much he packs in there, Martin, not least of which is the failure of this policy is being blamed on the legal system. The Tories saying things like, oh, we're going to have to change the legal system, ditch the Human Rights Act, that sort of thing. So it's being used to undermine some of the fundamental building blocks of society.
It is, and of course he's going on the attack there. He's not just saying it's a silly policy, he's saying it's malicious. And to a large extent, it is malicious. As I say, pointed out, we've got a world crisis. We went to war this week. Shouldn't there have been a parliamentary debate about that? And instead, we're discussing whether we can or can't overthrow international rules, because that's what we're talking about here. We won't abide by the... That's what the Tory right want to do. They want to say we don't want to be part of the European Court of Human Rights, which is nothing to do with the EU. It was set up after World War II to enforce human rights in Europe. And it's, you know, and they're prepared to wreck that in order to get through a policy which won't work anyway. Meanwhile, the house is burning down and we're going to war in the Middle East, but nobody's talking about it.
And also, he's talking about this being originally an Israeli policy, which...
the Israelis have already done this, yeah. And it didn't work.
So we've picked this up from the Israeli embassy. That's kind of, they have decided, you know, we've said, what do you think we should do? And they said, well, you could try this. It didn't work for us, but give it a go.
Well, that's right. I mean, Israel is a very racist society. They don't take asylum seekers. They don't even allow the Palestinians who lived there for thousands of years to live there, so they don't want anybody else. And that's their mentality.
I mean, there's another point which is being made regularly, which is what would Labour do? What would you do?
Well, I think the obvious thing is that the French have said all along, you could come over here and process these people in France who want to have British asylum in Britain. And they should, you know, they have to get in the boats to come across the channel because they can't claim asylum in Britain at the moment in France. But you could just say, right, all those who want to claim asylum in Britain, form an orderly queue here and we will assess you before you get, and then we'll, if you, those who pass get sent on the ferry.
Can you even have a sort of reception centre?
Well, that's right. You've got to accept that you're going to have to take some refugees. And this is the problem. The Tories don't want to have any refugees and they can't do that. You've got to have some of them.
Things like toilets, maybe dormitories, where people can come and then just be processed through the British asylum system over there. That's not going to cost a fortune. And also, of course, it means that people aren't dying on the way across.
That's right. We want to stop people getting into small boats. The only reason they get into small boats, because international law, as it stands, unless we change, the British rules are you've got to be in Britain to claim. We could say, if you made it to the Calais or whatever, we'll process you there. Or better still, we could process people even further away so that they don't even have to bother coming to Calais.
You could set up a little consulate or something over there. Why not? It's an obvious thing to do.
Well, the reason is because the Tory right wing don't want any of these people at all at any price. And they've promised their core voters, including their membership, that they can get out of this. You can't get out of dealing with refugees in today's world. Most refugees are, in fact, in the developing world, in poor countries. People are fleeing from the war in Yemen or, where the Palestinians, the Israelis are saying, you can have the Palestinians, we don't want them, why don't they go to Britain? They could go to Germany. We said to the Hong Kong Chinese, they can come because they're being bullied by the Chinese. We said to the Ukrainians, just walk in.
Israelis said they wanted the Palestinians to go to Ireland, for God's sake.
But that's because the Irish have been hostile to the genocide. So that's why they're shooting their mouths off. You know, if you like the Palestinians so much, you can have them because we don't want them.
Not all these people, by any means, are asylum seekers, are they? Many of them are economic migrants.
Some may be, and that's the whole point of having a processing system. I know that, you know, my friend, I know people who work in this field.
What I'm saying is many of those people are coming over as economic migrants. They want to make money here and send it back home. And they're finding that when they get here, they are beholden to the people traffickers. They are having to pay them. So they can't even send much of the money back home for the first year or 2 years of being in Britain because they're having to pay the people that traffic them here.
Most of these people, 80% of them, when they are processed, are seen to be genuine asylum seekers. Some are economic migrants. I know people who work in the system because they're contracted to do it. I know there's a friend of mine who's an expert on Zimbabwe. People from Zimbabwe turn up in Britain claiming political asylum, that they're going to be persecuted by Mugabe. Some of them are, and they get asylum. Some of them are not. They are, as you say, economic migrants. They want a better life in Britain. They are deported. That's the whole point of having a system for assessment, so that the economic migrants are weeded out. We do have economic migrants as well, most of whom come on visas to work in the health service.
Throw their passports away as well. So I don't believe when you say that there's only 20% of them that are economic. I think there are far more.
The facts are that it is 80% of those that have been processed so far.
If them are coming over from Africa, I have absolutely no problem with them doing it to try and make a better life. But I think this whole idea of saying all these people are fleeing war zones and persecution is just poppycock. It's something that the Labour Party have been coming up with for many years and have slowly but surely, under Starmer, have decided, well, actually, no, we need to knuckle down and let's actually address the problem of economic migrants. Because, this is actually a policy of the British government, the Tories too, to have more economic migrants because it forces down wages.
I know this is your line, Tony, but the fact is the Tories do want economic migrants, in fact, because they're brought in this visa system, as you know, and actually that's causing huge problems in the health service, hospitality and care, because the people coming in don't earn enough in those industries, if you want to call them that, to qualify for the visas. So they've had to make a waiver for things like care workers. The most of the people coming in who are economic migrants get here with a work job already laid out for them. They've got a job in Britain. They come and they do that job. We get people coming working in IT. We get people coming to the universities. We get all sorts of people coming in as economic migrants. When the economic migrants stop coming, it means your economy is going into recession. And they are going to stop coming because we're going to have a crash.
Not on the boats.
No, they're not. The people coming across in the rubber dinghies are not people. Look, they're people escaping from stuff. They're not people looking. They are looking for a better life. Of course they are. But there's a big, big difference between people who are refugees and asylum seekers are basically one category. Economic migrants are another. There is a bit of an overlap. I accept that. And that's the reason why you have a processing system to assess whether people are genuinely in fear of political persecution or war. Most of them, I'm afraid, are, because wars are raging all over the planet. And many of them in ex-colonies of the British Empire. And they turn up on our shores.
just well, as they was, turned up on the French shores, in Germany, and in Spain even more so. Far more in Greece.
It certainly might seem like that if you listen to this show, but actually most of the world is not torn by war. Certainly a lot of poverty around, but not necessarily people being threatened in their homes and having to leave. But so let's hear from the third of our trio on this unbelievable Rwanda fiasco, which is Nigel Farage from the Reform Party speaking again on the Peston show this week.
No, I like Jacob very much, but he will always, always put the party first. Whether the party's doing the right thing or the wrong thing, it's always party first with Jacob. It was, I'm afraid, over Theresa May's surrender document, and thus it is again. But, I mean, look, to be honest with you, I think whether these amendments had gone through and we'd had a toughened-up Rwanda bill or what the government had put down in the first place, I don't think any of it makes any difference anyway. None of it is going to survive legal challenge because of international agreements that we've signed. There was no preparedness in the British government to change those. And I feel quite angry because I think for over 600 days, ever since Boris Johnson gave that speech at Lyd Airport, where we were told that people would go to Rwanda, we wasted hundreds of millions of pounds of taxpayers' money, vast amounts of parliamentary time, press time, people's energy and emotions, and it's taken us no nearer any solutions whatsoever. Frankly, the whole thing is a charade.
And what did you make of Paul Kagame, the president of Rwanda, saying, well, if he was in a charitable mood, he might give us some money back?
Yeah, I mean, even Kagame from Rwanda has had enough of it all. Even he's bored and tired of the ridiculous games that are being played by a Conservative Party, constantly navel-gazing, always at war with each other. In fact, they've spent more time since the election of 2019 talking about themselves and their own differences than they have getting on with the country. So, no, when even Rwanda are offering to give you the money back, you know the game is up.
Which presumably means that Reform, the party that you helped to create, has got to challenge the Tories in every single seat.
I think they do, yes. And there's always been this argument, you know, about UKIP or the Brexit Party. Should we stand against Eurosceptic Tories or indeed Eurosceptic Labour MPs over the years? I have to say, I do agree with Richard Tice when he says that actually the Conservative Party are the problem and not the solution here, because they pretend at elections to be things that they frankly don't do in office. So I don't doubt Richard's determination to stand everywhere in the next election.
So that's first of two clips we've got from Nigel Farage on tonight's show, on the Peston show. But Martin, he's actually with you. He's saying, and me, he's saying, look, it isn't going to work legally. The whole thing is a waste of time. They're banging their heads against a brick wall.
Well, that's what I got from what he was saying as well. But then he's then got to explain to the people who want to stop all these people coming what his policy actually is, which he hasn't done. I mean, what's he going to do? He didn't come out with anything about that at all. He's just saying he's an opportunist. And he can see here that the Tory party is ripping itself apart about this. And he's just saying, well, they ought to have just been able to force it through. They can't force it through. It's silly. But I mean, when Nigel Farage says the game's up, the game is up.
Martin, to be fair, that was only a short clip. He may well have said something like that about that later in that. And we'll put full links up to that interview with Farage and what the one with Rees-Mogg as well for your delectation, dear listeners. If you think I'm sounding a bit groggy this week, you're absolutely right. I've had COVID. I mean, it's not been too bad, really. Just a kind of an evening and the next morning of being almost unable to move, but certainly with a little bit of few aspirins and whatever, I'm kind of getting through it okay. I thought I'd better not come into the studio, so I'm talking on Skype from home this week, and you know, to make sure that Ron, who we're hoping to have in about half an hour, isn't, and Martin and Dave aren't subjected to my disease, which I mean, I'll be honest with you, this is what you would always do. If you're a sensible person, if you did have a cold, you don't go places because you know you're going to be possibly passing it on. So it's all just common sense, really. I don't really know if there's any need to, you know, enforce all these as massive rules everywhere. I don't know. You know, I suppose those that have got no common sense will go and spread it, I guess. So it's beholden on the authorities to try and encourage people to be sensible. But anyway, we have our next item is if I can find it. Yeah, is to look at electric cars. And I've got a bit of a tale here. Again, a longer interview, which I'll put up on our show page later at thisweek.org.uk, about electric cars. And let's get your take on this before we hear from James Tweedy, Martin, who's a London-based freelance journalist and also a member of the Workers' Party. He's, and I think, no to NATO as well. And, yes, George Galloway's little group. So we just heard from Nigel Farage there about him standing candidates all over the country against the Tories. Well, George Galloway, as we heard before Christmas's Workers' Party, has said that they are going to stand, I think it's 50 candidates around the country in all the Labour marginals just to harass the Labour Party. What do you think of this tactic, Martin, for both Farage and for Galloway to harry the Tory and Labour duopoly from both sides?
Well, I'll believe that Nigel Farage is going to stand down the Reform Party when it happens, because, of course, he marched them all up to the top of the hill and he marched them down again last time. And, of course, the Reform Party is basically a private organisation run by Nigel Farage. It isn't a political party like the Labour Party or the Liberal Democrats, which has an internal structure with votes and so on. But Farage set it up as a private company. Yes, so he can turn it off or on as he wishes.
That because they were infiltrated by MI5 and Tommy Robinson.
Well, I mean, I don't know. The reasons for it are quite, you know, it's a new kind of politics. You know, political parties, even in our unwritten constitution or any constitution, political parties don't have to be internally democratic. The democracy is at the ballot box on the day.
If your state security service is going to allow political parties to be to have outside organisations infiltrate and undermine them, then surely you have to have some fairly extreme measures to make sure that you can still have some sort of independence. But the point, you haven't addressed the question at all, have you? Which is it a legitimate tactic? Is it going to be, you think, a useful tactic to have people, not necessarily to the right of the Tories or to the left of Labour, but literally with more radical policies from both sides eating into their vote and threatening to overturn their fragile majorities, particularly in marginal seats in this year's general election?
Well, I think the tactics are different on the two sides. Yeah, so that's why I was drawing attention, first of all, to the Reform and what their tactics should be. Don't forget that they're standing in every seat, not just some seats, every seat. That's what they're saying. The Workers' Party, on the other hand, are saying they're going to stand in 50 seats. Now, from my point of view, as a member of the Labour Party, if they stood in the Labour heartland seats and showed the discontent amongst the Labour heartland voters, that would be their most useful deployment. If they stand in the marginals, if they are successful, they will simply allow Tory MPs who should have been sent to the scaffold to survive. Now, they may be happy with that because they just want to make trouble as part of overthrowing the system as a whole. But a lot of Labour voters will feel cheated that, for example, what will happen in the mayoral election for London, which Galloway's standing, because the Tories have changed the electoral system back to that stuff, the system, so that it's first past the post. Every vote for Galloway will be a vote not for Sadiq Khan. Now, Sadiq Khan is probably going to win. I'm pretty sure he will. But if he did lose, it will be a Tory who would win and not George Galloway. That's first past the post. And if you don't organise your troops properly and first past the post, you lose. Ask Bobby Sands. Bobby Sands won under first past the post. Everybody else had to stand down on his side.
But the whole point of this system is to actually move the main party politically towards you. That's the point of it, and that's what they hope to do by it. I wonder if you think that they'll succeed. They certainly did in triggering the referendum, for example, with the Conservatives. The Brexit Party before that, UKIP, had an enormous influence at basically threatening the Tory Party. Look, we will do all these things unless you have a referendum and unless you do the referendum you promised. So that they can surely have a bit of an effect on the main party.
What allowed UKIP to get a grip was because of the proportional elections to the European Parliament, and of course the fact that people in Europe didn't care much about Europe, so they didn't even participate in the European elections. And that's what allowed them to establish a political base and to raise funds in order to undermine the Tory party. But in a first-past-the-post election, like in South Armagh in 1980, you've got to stick together or you lose.
Martin, those UKIP MEPs just went along to Brussels to a talking shop. They had no power, actual power.
They got 30 grand a year each, and they got a job, and they got a platform. And on the basis of that, they were able to harry the Tory party. It won't work under first past the post. Insofar as the Reform Party stands at every... If the Reform Party stand at every constituency, as they've said, Starmer will be rubbing his hands because they will just peel off the last 10 or 15% of the Tory vote in those constituencies. And that will help the Labour Party mainstream. The Workers' Party, if they stand 50 candidates in the Labour marginals, will be helping the Tory party mainstream because that's how first-past-the-post elections work. It's like the difference between Aussie rules football and soccer.
Martin, you're being a bit slippery. Will these parties actually succeed, as they did in with the referendum and the Tories and UKIP? Will they actually succeed in moving politically the major parties or not?
I think the logic behind what the Workers' Party is doing is that they want to raise the issues of socialism, leaving NATO and so on, which were virtually impossible to raise in the mainstream. So, you know, it's what the SWP used to do when they stood in elections and respect before after them. And from that point of view, they see the election simply as a means of communicating their more radical message. And by standing in the marginals, what they may do is alienate core Labour voters who feel that what they're actually doing is just messing up our game. Now, it's up to them, and they're entitled to do it. There's no reason why they shouldn't do it. But under a first-past-the-post setup, it's likely to lead to perverse results, even when they're successful. I want the Reform Party to stand in every constituency, because that will peel off a substantial chunk of the Tory vote, and under first-past-the-post, Starmer will win.
But not Galloway.
Galloway will possibly... Galloway is not going to be elected as Mayor of London. That's not my assessment. But he has been a sufficiently strong campaigner to win by-elections in the past. But he won't win Mayor of London. I don't think he will.
It's very frustrating because you seem to be sort of missing this point. The basic point, what this is all about, is about moving these main parties. And it seems to me that the other very good purpose of parties like this, it's extremely healthy in my mind, is that, say, for example, you've got sitting MPs like Jeremy Corbyn, who's been bullied around whilst a Labour MP under a despotic leader like someone like Sunak or Starmer, then they can go and hop over to one of these, become an MP for one of these other parties too.
Well, this, as you will note, Jeremy Corbyn has not resigned from the Labour Party. He's been expelled, but he hasn't resigned. Nor has he set up another party, because as far as he's concerned, as far as I'm concerned, he is the Labour Party. That's what Ken Livingstone argued as well. And of course, Ken Livingstone, by winning the mayoral election in London, was able he made Blair bend the knee, and Blair had to invite him back into the Labour Party. The Labour Party is it's part of the traditional fabric of our politics. It's funded by the trade unions. How many trade unions are funding the Workers' Party? If they want to get anywhere, they've got to take the union money with them, and that means taking the Labour Party brand. Starmer is not the Labour Party. He's just a passing cloud. We are still in there, and we're still going to be there at the finish. But it's under first past the post. You've got to pick your fights very carefully.
I mean, should we listen to Keir Starmer when he said that he never thought Jeremy Corbyn had a chance of winning the general elections in 2017 and 2019?
Well, Starmer is who he is. He represents the right wing of the Labour Party and he's embedded in the establishment. He's going to say that, isn't he? I think the establishment was shocked by how well Jeremy Corbyn did, and they freaked out, which is why they went to town on making sure they broke his legs. But that doesn't mean that Jeremy Corbyn was wrong. I think he was wrong because he should have committed to PR. You know, that's my particular hobby horse. That's what happened in New Zealand in the 1980s, and the left in New Zealand never looked back. And it's just basic, you know, playing, you know, 21st century rugby union instead of kick and chase. But there you are.
Right. So, I mean, it seems to me that Starmer was actually, along with Peter Mandelson, trying to actively undermine Jeremy Corbyn.
Absolutely.
rather than just not supporting them, he really, if he was an honest man, he would be coming out and saying, I'm trying to destroy his chances of winning that election, because that's the kind of a trilateral commission role that he's been playing. Anyway, look, let's get back to James Tweedy and the electric cars. What do you think about electric cars? Have you swapped from a petrol to an electric one, Martin?
I don't buy new cars, Tony, of any kind, so that's not really an issue. I mean, electric cars are no doubt part of a solution to our problems, but of course producing electric cars can be extremely destructive, just as everything that we do can be destructive. You know, lithium mines, you know, there's all sorts of there was a coup in Bolivia to try and control the lithium mines. You know, electric cars, I'm in favour of more public transport. Why do we have to have cars at all? I mean, you know, we'd love to have some cars, and maybe they should be electric. But the real answers aren't modern, you know, sort of ecological cars. We need to just rethink how we get people from A to B.
Yeah, it's a socialist, collectivised transport system. It's called the tram, the railway.
That's right. Although you've got to be careful, you know, that isn't not everything can be done like that. You know, there's got to be flexibility.
You mentioned Ken Livingstone. This experiment he tried in London back in the 1980s was a tremendous thing, where he was aiming to make all public transport in London free. And as a result, there were far less, I think something like 1,500 less serious accidents on the road the first year he tried it out. I think it was about 1983. And it was an enormous success. He was actually bringing all the bus fares down and using the rates to cross-subsidise London transport. The other thing is, there were less and less new cars registered on London's roads every year. This seems to be the carrot approach, which works extremely well. The stick approach is charging everybody to use roads if they've got a diesel car or a petrol car, and trying to force everybody to get on the bandwagon and keep up with the Joneses and get an electric car. The other thing is, of course, that these electric cars have to be charged up from somewhere. It's not generally going to be windmills doing the job. It's going to be nuclear power stations, isn't it?
Well, it may well be. I mean, there's no, you know, the idea that there are technical fixes for ecological problems is very corporate. Ultimately, ecological problems are political problems, and you need to change the politics, and you need to redistribute wealth, things like that. It's not a question of having a technical solution. Oh, yes, well, we'll have new ecological cars, but they're still cars on the same old motorways, built in the same old way, etc. It's just, you know, it's a way of change. Everything must change so everything stays the same, yeah? And capitalism loves this stuff. You know, we've got a new thing, yeah, ecological cars, you know. What about that?
For example, they had lots of car traffic jams in Singapore. So their government, which is a sort of benevolent socialist dictatorship, they decided to just continue every year, increase the car tax by about £2,000 equivalent every year, until they ended up, once the car tax was 20 grand, with around about the right number of cars on the road and very little congestion.
Well, that's right. I mean, you shouldn't rule out either carrots or sticks. The question is, what are you trying to do? I mean, in Singapore, it's got a very limited land area. It's obvious that you can't have everybody driving around in cars. It's not like Los Angeles, you know. And, of course, you've also got the problem of whatever you've done in the past, however silly it was, you're stuck with the infrastructure. So even the railways in this country have got, you know, if Brunel's 5 feet railways had been the standard, we'd be a lot better off than we are now, because we're using George Stephenson's 4'2" or whatever it was, which basically meant a carriage pulled by a horse. Whereas Brunel was a much bigger thinker, said, well, you know, why can't we just have much wider tracks when we can pack them in? Yeah, but of course all the stations and everything we've got now, the infrastructure, the built infrastructure, is on George Stephenson's scale.
Well, actually the British Rail privatised post-World War II was never a pack-em-in service. It was actually a nice, comfortable service with plenty of room.
Well, that's the whole point about what Brunel's carriages would have been like. There would have been loads more room, so you wouldn't have to pack them in. You'd have more room for people to enjoy the ride. But, of course, once you've committed your system to being on a 4'6" scale, then you're stuck with it. It's like the QWERTY keyboard or whatever. It's just path dependency.
Another problem with the railways is these. I mean, we had Paddington Station shut off for about a week because of some problem with overhead lines. And then they started changing the messages, apparently, so that they weren't talking about it as overhead lines. But the idea of having electricity delivered to the engine from above rather than diesel or some other, or even steam, is a disaster because it creates this massive extra load of infrastructure, massive extra costs, massive extra fraudulent contracts to maintain it. And the other thing, you know, so you end up that, oh, well, you can't get your train to Paddington because, there's something wrong with the overhead wires. And so, to me, I mean, I remember when we were first over in New Zealand, hearing over there, oh, they tried out electric overhead wires in New Zealand for a few years. It was so expensive, and it's such a, you know, more of a democratic country that they just scrapped the idea. They sold all these electric wires and their towers off for scrap. Talking of which, we're getting towards electric cars very slowly. What do you make of the shutdown of Port Talbot?
Well, I thought it was interesting when I heard the news this morning. James Cleverly at the World Economic Forum going out, he wants Britain to be more like the US, low-tax states in the Americas and Asia. And I was thinking, yes, Haiti and Bangladesh. And then the next thing that comes up is the last steel manufacturing plant in Britain is to close because it's owned by a foreign firm, Tata, who are based in India. And they're basically interested in making global profits. And, they're not interested in an industrial strategy for Britain, are they? And that means that Britain, in fact, will not produce any high-grade steel at all. Germany still produces quite a lot, although they're going to not be able to produce much more in the future because of the stupidity of cutting off the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. But ultimately, of course, World War III is going to be won by the countries with steelworks, and that's Russia and China.
Good point. Yeah, I mean, so one of the things that's really, I mean, I was looking through the BBC's report to check it, really, because this new so-called green, you just have to laugh. It's like having a smart forge or something. Just ridiculous words they use to try and make things sound cool when actually they're rubbish, is this massive electric arc furnace, which can only deal with scrap. So you can feed a load of scrap steel into it, which it can buzz away using millions of volts of God knows what and melt it down a bit. And so you can then, but it can't actually make steel. It can't make new steel. And I mean, this was actually, the whole process is really that one of deindustrialization, which is also a process of stopping a country's ability to fight a world war. Now, you and I know that one is looming right now.
Yeah, I mean, there's no way that we're going to get Britain back on a war footing, even if we were to attempt it, because it's just the infrastructure's just gone. The deindustrialisation has come about because of the financialisation of the British economy. We haven't, in the 1980s, the Tories, spat out the idea of industrial strategy. We don't need an industrial strategy. The entrepreneurs know what to do. It's going to be a new economy. It won't look like the old economy. All these old industries will have to go, and we'll have all these new industries. We're not quite sure what they'll be. Some people are talking about the internet. What's that going to be like? And the whole idea, it's a sort of magical thinking, because in actual fact, you do have to have an industrial strategy. The Chinese and the Russians have definitely got one, but we've not bothered. And of course, it's all to do with financialization. We are a massive casino with a country attached, and we don't really need a steelworks in those circumstances, do we? Waste of money.
But the point is that we almost certainly will need steel. I suppose the deeper point is that we're just going to have to buy whatever weapons we need from the Yanks.
Well, that is absolutely true, although they have got problems with their supply chains as well. I don't think we need to think in terms of we've got to arm up for World War III. It's too late for the West to do that, actually. It's just too late. The years of deindustrialisation have deindustrialised the American Midwest and the north of Britain. And that's not coming back. We probably do need to produce steel in small quantities, but if we're going to do it, we'll have to produce it in the public sector, because Tata Steel can't make any money doing it at Port Talbot. So you might have to subsidise it, which means you might have to raise taxes on people like Rees-Mogg if you wanted to subsidise steel. But then we subsidise farming, we subsidise loads of things, don't we?
Tata has been paid £500,000 in order to make this change.
Well, that's right, but they've looked at it and said, we can't make any money. Even with this subsidy, we can't make any money at it. So, and in any case, as you say, it may be the wrong thing to do, because you might want to keep the capacity to make raw steel, because you just might want to do that. Not for military reasons. You know, you might want to make bridges and things, you know. I don't know. This is why you need an industrial strategy. But an industrial strategy, has, you know, you can't just produce one on the hoof. You've got to have a long-term think about what actually is going to work.
Another strategy at Port Talbot would be to say, stick two fingers up to Tata, say, okay, pull out then, and then you can use the plant, spend your £500,000, re-employ some of these 7,000 people being sold off to start making steel there, and you can turn it back into a going concern, owned and controlled locally.
Well, British Steel was nationalised under exactly those conditions in the late 70s, wasn't it? So the steel industry in the country was, you know, privately owned, couldn't make any money, and then the government took it over. At that point, you've got to decide how much steel do you want. But, of course, eventually the Tories, you know, the Tories came to power and they said, well, just get rid of it. So they did. And that's why we haven't got one.
Right. So, anyway, I guess finally we're going to get to electric cars. We've been talking all around things like steel and energy. I mean, it's ironic, isn't it, that it was Thyssen and Krupps, the two big steel companies, that financed the early days of the Nazi Party by giving a dollar a ton, I think it was, of steel they sold directly into the Nazi bank accounts. And, of course, this is one of the things that turned the Nazi Party into a party of war. Because they knew.
Well, it was always a party of war, Tony. There wasn't much doubt about that.
It certainly put a bit of a rocket under them to know that every ton of steel that was used to make weapons or anything else in Germany was going to go straight into the coffers of the party. And this is fascism. This is the merger of corporate and political power. That's what those steel companies were up to. And that's why it's so important to keep control of these. But we can't be bothered, apparently. So anyway, on the electricity and electric cars. Now, there is a lot of talking up of this stuff. There's a lot of keeping up with the Joneses. If I'm ever stopping at a motorway services, I always pass groups of usually couples or small families sitting there looking in a glum fashion, waiting for their car to charge up. And this is, you know, it's massively increased the uncertainty of doing any kind of long distance journey in your car, is it's a hell of a lot quicker to just spend 5 minutes filling your car up and carrying on than it is to sit and wait for it to get charged. But anyway, James Tweedy's mum did do what she thought was the right thing and bought a Volvo, a hybrid Volvo. The only trouble was that it was playing up, it's been playing up the whole time. So in the longer piece, he gives the whole story. But here is the nub of it, where first of all, the car goes out of control because it's got some sort of software that links the steering wheel to the actual wheels. They don't actually touch, you know, there's no kind of direct link. So they kind of do their own thing sometimes, and which is a little bit worrying. And also then the battery was completely flat, and it wouldn't, that the hybrid motor, when you started out, would not charge the battery. So as soon as you stopped the car, that was it. It was dead, and you couldn't get in or out, and you couldn't do anything with it. So anyway, and he'll tell us at the end what Volvo have done about this. So let's have a listen to James Tweedy now.
So you got another car, another of the same model of car from them as a replacement. But this new one, right, this new one, doesn't work. It didn't work either. They had to change the battery on it. And you know these things, these electric cars and these hybrid cars, the battery, you know, people complain that the battery is a major part of it, and it's like one of these lithium ion batteries like in your phone, but much bigger. And the cost of a new battery is like the cost of buying a new car, the same car, you know. But they changed the battery on this thing, and it still doesn't work. You know, it's a self-charging and plug-in hybrid, but it doesn't charge, it doesn't hold the charge, so it can't drive, you know. I parked it there, I let the engine run for about 10 or 15 minutes because there wasn't a lot of petrol left in it, and I turned it off, and then it wouldn't, and then the battery hadn't charged very much, or it wasn't holding the charge, because then it wouldn't work again, you know, it wouldn't even open the doors.
Well, look, let me tell you, with a Morris 1000 from the 1950s, if you run it for just 2 or 3 minutes, it's charged the battery enough to start itself again, even if it's totally dead flat.
Well, yeah, what's going on? So they came to get it, right, you know, she phoned them and they came to get it, apparently. This is what they told, this is what she told me, or my brother told me. And they came from the dealership to get it and fix it and take it away and fix it. But they said they couldn't take it away because it wouldn't start. And I was like, you know, when she told me this, I was like, yes, that's the problem. It won't start because the battery's dead. Like, didn't they bring the tow truck to tow it away or something, you know? Didn't they bring the lorry with the crane on it? And, yeah, it was like, it's totally crazy, you know, they're like incompetent.
So, yes, that's James Tweedy. And he tells the full story of how she was in the cemetery and the car, just with a mind of its own, just took off up an embankment and into a tree. Also, he talks about his experience of actually getting the thing going, jump-starting it from his own car. I mean, this is not only is this damn thing a disaster, it looks as if they've been given a duff car as a replacement for the first duff car, and now the thing is just a two-ton hulk sitting outside the house that she's paid £35,000-£40,000 for that doesn't do anything, Martin.
Well, I mean, you could say, well, this is the teething troubles of a new technology, and obviously, you know, that's the minimum that it is. Or it may well be that this isn't really viable. But, I mean, as I say, there isn't enough white width of thought. You know, having a new generation of cars is the limit of people's ambition. Maybe we need to think about having a less car-dependent lifestyle. Which, you know, would involve completely different, you know, wider changes. But of course, you know, what's happening now is that certain things are being pushed as that's the green thing to do. And therefore, if you're opposed to it, then you're not green. But a lot of it is just recycled capitalism and built in obsolescence and, you know, the latest thing, you know, you buy for Christmas and then you throw it away the day after.
Yeah, so my take on that is I think I'm going to put that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk and do a little YouTube with a picture of the car, not of his mum, but put an appeal out for the Chiswick branch of Volvo to come and give her a new car and to service the old one rather than, I mean, it's extraordinary, isn't it? She has phoned up the garage and told them this new car replacement you've given me is it won't start, and then they turn up, and then they say, oh, it won't start, so we'll have to go away. This is the sort of attitude that I think I get the impression anyway, that these dealerships used to dealing with petrol and diesel cars are so fed up with the failure rates of the electric cars that they would rather just not have to deal with another replacement, one on top of the other, of a car which is basically fundamentally flawed.
Well, that's right. I mean, there's talk about 737 in the US that's just so many problems with it that it's just going to have to be taken out of service. This stuff does happen. Capitalism isn't all perfect. Lots of poor decisions are made. And of course, ultimately, poor decisions lead to poor results.
So is it just a lack of regulation or what?
Well, it's regulation is you've got to have the right regulation. Not too much, not too little. And again, it comes back to industrial strategy. What are you trying to achieve? But of course, some things, lots of things, it's much better off to just have them in public ownership. Car industry is oligopolistic. There are state-owned car companies around the world. And they used to, I mean, Volkswagen, for example, was state-owned and employee-owned. You know, things like water industries, there is no case whatsoever for them to be in the private sector. We've privatised the water industry in this country. It's absolutely insane. And all that's happened is we've ended up with a polluted water supply and the system in collapse, which was exactly predictable from any economics textbook. But that was the financialisation of our economy. And we wonder why we're way behind everybody else in the developing world, because, you know, countries which are developing have got an opportunity to not make our mistakes. They see what we've done and say, well, we're not doing that.
Well, in a way, this is the biggie, Martin, because if you link this up to what's been going on in the Red Sea, there could be threats to the oil supplies, couldn't there? So maybe that's what this whole electric car thing is all about, to make sure there are at least some people who can get around by charging up their cars when there's no oil.
Well, I don't. I think the oil situation is very tense for the reasons you say. And I think that the idea of moving towards a new technology which will protect the earth, this is very much, you know, the general philosophy, isn't it? The World Economic Forum, right through the Green Party, everybody thinks that that's what we're going to do. But, you know, from my point of view, I think that we've got some big hurdles in the road before we even get to making decisions about things like that. And, you know, if the oil price goes through the roof as a result of a major war in the Middle East, the economy will crash. That means there'll be no money for investment in anything, because the economy will have crashed. You'll have to completely reform the production of money, all sorts of things, before you can get to discussing what you might do about ecological crisis. And I'm not saying there isn't an ecological crisis, and it ain't just climate change. But we can't deal with any of it, because we're in the middle of a galloping world war, which means that you know, all resources are being sucked into a black hole.
By who? I suppose we should say something about Davos, shouldn't we, this week? What do you make of this World Economic Forum?
Well, I mean, we all know it exists. I mean, it existed for years and nobody paid much attention to it, but it's now become a kind of thing that everybody kind of knows is going on. It's interesting who turned up and who didn't and what went on there, because this is the elite having a little chat amongst themselves. Zelensky was there, as you might expect, and he hoped to have a meeting with the Chinese Prime Minister. And he thought he was going to get one, but the Chinese just refused to meet him. There was every opportunity for him to meet them. They just didn't want to meet him, and they weren't prepared to talk to him. That was a significant thing for me, because it just shows that where the wind's blowing. And, of course, the Chinese turn up to the World Economic Forum because they can hardly be excluded. I don't know how many Russians turn up, because they're such baddies that maybe they're not even invited. But, I couldn't swear to that. Who gets to go, and what sort of things that come out is of importance, because these people are very powerful, aren't they?
Well, yes, of course they certainly are. Yeah. One thing we haven't mentioned on the show is the Kingswood by-election, have we? And Chris Skidmore standing down.
Yeah. Well, as it's in four weeks, last Thursday it'll be held. It's going to be a big test for the Starmer Labour Party, in the sense that they've got 11, Chris Skidmore had an 11,000 majority. They should be able to overturn that, given the opinion polls, national opinion polls. If they don't, there'll be a bit of gnashing of teeth. And of course, if the Workers' Party were to stand in Kingswood, they might siphon off some Labour votes and make it more likely that they wouldn't win. And that's presumably what they're going to do at the general election. We'll see. It's a Labour-Tory marginal, I would say, at the moment.
Yeah, the Bristol Post has published a full list of general election seat forecasts for Bristol, saying the Tories are headed for colossal losses. A newly created constituency, Bristol Central, is expected to be hotly contested between Labour and the Greens, as we were hearing last week. Guy Pulteney from the Greens being pretty certain that they've got a very good chance of making that their second Green MP. I think they'd be quite proud to see Bristol delivering a new party to the House of Commons, which is desperately in need of a refresh. But the Tories are being forecast to lose 3 out of every 5 MPs they currently have in the Bristol area. The model shows Labour would increase the number of MPs to 7.
Well, I mean, that's pretty much in line with what I've been seeing as well. It's pretty much in line with what I've been seeing as well. I think it is interesting that the Greens may take Bristol Central. But of course, I have to say this, Tony, they're in favour of things like electric cars and road pricing. So there you are.
Well, yes, but I mean, at least they're not in favour of doubling allotment fees. So some of the things that this Labour mayor has been doing, yeah, multiplying by 300% the fees for people living on boats in the harbour. This sort of fascist behaviour of just literally forcing, ethnically cleansing Bristol of its poorer people doesn't seem to be really in tune with traditional Labour values.
No, I think a lot of people who voted for Labour in Bristol West in the past, as it was now Bristol Central, would be of a Corbynista persuasion. And the Green Party are definitely making sort of come-hither noises to them. And I suspect a lot of those people will indeed vote for them, just to spite Sir Keir Starmer.
This is the plan, anyway. It says in the wider region, the Tories will lose Filton and Bradley Stoke, which would go to Labour, and Thornbury and Yates, which would go to the Lib Dems. In another contested election, Labour is likely to gain Weston-super-Mare from the Tories. So this is the result of trying to equalise out these constituencies. Is it a bit of a fix-up? It doesn't seem to be working for the Tories, if it is.
Well, I mean, it is a fix in the sense that, as I said last week, that they've redrawn these constituency boundaries on the basis of the existing electoral registers, not on the basis of the demography. And that, of course, means that there are a lot of inner-city areas, there are a lot of people not registered to vote. Yeah. So that in fact makes them underrepresented in the new setup, and the government have been pretty hard nosed about trying to fix things. I mean, the other thing that they've done, of course, is you've got to have a photo ID to vote, which means a lot of people won't vote. They'll turn up, but they won't be allowed to vote. This is all attempts to try and rig things, just like Priti Patel changed the election system for the Labour London mayor in order to try and, you know, fix it for their party. But they're in such dire straits that even with all the fixing, it looks like they're going to be thrashed. And a good thing too, really.
Right, well, we'll be being joined by Ron Mandel after the break.
Thousand. touch of hate at Rome, you will rise to a greater power. We will win ourselves a home. You'll get the power and the glory, glory. Forever and ever and ever. You'll get the power and the glory, the power. Forever and ever and ever. You'll get the power and the glory, forever and ever and ever.
Describes the prophet Elijah's encounter with God after he has fled from King Ahab, who seeks his life. In this encounter, God is made known not in great signs of nature, but in a sound of sheer silence. From there, Elijah continues his mission as a prophet of the Lord.
Here begins the ninth verse of the 19th chapter of the first book of Kings. Elijah came to a cave on Mount Horeb and spent the night there. Then the word of the Lord came to him, saying, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" He answered, "I have been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the Israelites have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. I alone am left, and they are seeking my life to take it away." He said, "Go out and stand on the mountain before the Lord, for the Lord is about to pass by." Now there was a great wind, so strong that it was splitting mountains and breaking rocks in pieces before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake. But the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire. But the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, a sound of sheer silence. When Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his mantle and went out and stood at the entrance of the cave. Then there came a voice to him that said, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" He answered, "I have been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the Israelites have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. I alone am left, and they are seeking my life to take it away." Then the Lord said to him, "Go, return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus. When you arrive, you shall anoint Hazael as king of Aram, and you shall anoint Jehu, son of Nimshi, as king over Israel. And you shall anoint Elisha, son of Shaphat of Abel-Meholah, as prophet in your place. Whoever escapes from the sword of Hazael, Jehu shall kill. And whoever escapes from the sword of Jehu, Elisha shall kill. Yet I will leave 7,000 in Israel, all the knees that have not bowed to Baal, and every mouth that has not kissed him." Here ends the first lesson.
Well, that was from 1985. Where it's Propaganda by Jewel. I don't know why. It kind of reminds me of that band Sonia Christina was in. I'm not quite sure what the name of the band was. No idea why, but I love that stuff. You know, it was there was some pop music that came out that around 70s and 80s that was really good. That also the excerpt, the first reading from the first book of Kings that you heard. I wonder whether the churches, that was Croydon Minster, by the way, if the Eye of Sauron wants to go and shine on them and try and destroy them, give them, you know, maybe they won't succeed. But fascinating passages being quoted from the book of Kings about the behavior of Israel. And that was about the prophet Elijah there. And, yeah, and also before that, 1973, Jesus Christ Superstar. And do you know who it was that wrote the lyrics for that film, Martin? Not the for the songs, but the dialogue.
Well, no, I don't, Tony.
You know who? It was someone you can hear at 9 o'clock every Thursday afternoon on Radio 4, if you're around, or that's repeated at other points. That's Melvin Bragg. He actually was involved with Tim Rice and Andrew Lloyd Webber. And I've got a feeling there was another, can't remember the name of him anyway, who was involved in actually putting that amazing film together. So anyway, welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, me, Tony Gosling, and also we're joined in the studio by Ron Mandel, who's a former international relations lecturer. Hi, Ron.
Hey, Tony.
Now, let's start by, can you just introduce yourself? I know you've been on before, but to listeners a little bit about your trajectory through teaching.
My trajectory through teaching has taken me a circuitous path. I have a PhD in U.S. labor history. Then I began teaching as an itinerant lecturer in London. I taught through the Workers Education Association. I taught a number of polytechnics as they were known at that time in London. And then I started teaching American studies at the University of Northampton and eventually international relations and politics.
So where in the States are you from originally?
New York City.
I mean, it's obviously, you know, if you're going to marry an English woman, this is the place to be. But to what extent, are you a bit of an actual Anglophile rather than just someone who's in love with an English lady?
Oh, no, no. It's, I'm just in love with an English lady. That's the reason I'm here. I have no particular fondness for Britain, no feelings strongly one way or the other. It was pure romance.
Yeah. Do you get back to New York at all? Did you manage to persuade her to come over there?
We have a son who lives in Washington, D.C., and when he doesn't come here, we go to Washington, D.C., and I'm probably going to a wedding of my my nephew next autumn. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Anyway, look, let's get down to brass tacks a little bit. World Economic Forum is in full session this week over in Davos, up on the mountains of Switzerland, almost like some kind of James Bond movie, you know, where they have these kind of eagle's nests up at the top of the mountains where these people kind of get together. We've got a whole selection of people from around the world. They like to have the president. Obviously, they've got, you know, they haven't actually. I had a good look through the people there. Even though Fujitsu, who are behind the post office scandal, the horrific ripping off of all these postmasters and mistresses in connivance with the government here, they aren't mentioned. Even though they're one of the major sponsors of the World Economic Forum, there's no mention of them at all this year. There has been in previous years. They like to call themselves the change makers. The boss is, of course, Klaus Schwab. So they have the Premier of the People's Republic of China. They have Emmanuel Macron, Ursula von der Leyen, the President of Argentina, Prime Minister of Korea, the Spanish Prime Minister, President of Switzerland, They have also Vladimir Zelensky, Ukrainian president. What do you make of this meeting? Because one of the things that's always amused me over the years is it makes it very difficult to protest. We used to, in the 1990s, go all around Europe making a song and dance and a big fuss and a massive protest outside all of the things like the Eurotop summits around Europe and getting out on the streets and protesting the fact that all these people who are destroying our world are getting together to plan how they're going to take their evil plans forward. But what do you make of the WEF, Ron?
Well, I largely see it as a sideshow, really. I think the real decisions are made behind closed doors. They're not made at these conferences. I think these are conferences are basically for public consumption. Given the crisis that are taking place around the world, not the least in the Middle East, I think they're not really addressing the fundamental issues.
Well, they say they are. I mean, they are looking, for example, at getting the media to tell the truth, these sorts of things, because they've recognised that the press, for example, is being less and less trusted, particularly here in the UK. Actually, there's less and less public trust what we're seeing in the press. So, I mean, surely at least they're trying to address these things.
Well, I don't know how they're trying to address it, because the media basically is largely unaccountable. The media follows their own particular corporate interests. Even the BBC, which is supposed to be a public broadcasting station, very clearly is very biased in their reporting on a whole number of issues, particularly on Israel and Palestine.
Martin, what do you make of the World Economic Forum? Ron thinks that it's really it's not as high powered as they like to think it is.
I think that's right, because, I mean, people tend to focus on these, like the Bilderberg Group, the World Economic Forum, the Committee on Foreign Relations, all of these, you know, networking opportunities for the powerful.
Martin, there's a big difference between Bilderberg and the WEF. The WEF is all over the news, and it's live streamed. You can watch it all. Bilderberg is definitely not like that. It's all behind closed doors. In fact, they try and keep many of the names of the participants secret too. For example, the guy that's arranging for the Swedish government to join NATO is spotted there and photographed, but he's not on the lists.
All right, I accept there's a difference in the presentation of these meetings. Bilderberg, as you say, more secretive, traditionally denied that it existed at all, and so on. The WEF is more in the public eye. But as Ron just said, a lot of the real decisions are made in private. They're not made in public forums, not even Bilderberg. I mean, what is it, you know, if you want to do a deal with somebody, you don't go to a big public meeting to do that deal, do you? You find some way to communicate with them, privately, and you stitch up what you need to stitch up, and you come to the meeting with the deal already done, don't you, to tell everybody else what's going to happen.
I think it is fair, though, that these people do need to come together. It seems to me that there's two levels of the World Economic Forum. One level in which all these people are meeting behind closed doors, able to shake hands on signed verbal agreements, that sort of thing, about maybe letting a business use a country, doing a little deal to do with maybe a war, who knows. But that there is this whole public face where they then go round to the other side of the building, sit on the stage, and they have a kind of stage-managed panel discussion about how they're not going to do what they've just shaken someone's hand and done, Martin.
Well, I mean, it all depends upon what we're talking about, what deals have been done, doesn't it? I mean, you know, it may be. I mean, as I was saying earlier, Zelensky went to Davos expecting to meet the Chinese Prime Minister. And I understand that the Chinese knocked them back, you know. And it's like Kremlinology in the old days, you know. You're trying to see, well, what's going on there then? I think it's fairly clear what's going on there. The Chinese are basically giving him the cold shoulder. But all this is out in the open. No doubt there are contacts going on between the Chinese and the Ukrainian government, but you won't know who's involved. They'll be talking very, very quietly in a corner somewhere, and expressly so that other people can't hear what they're saying.
The Taoiseach of Ireland, the Prime Minister of Iraq. But the main point here, Ron, is that you've got a very, very close relationship between big business and government. Is that healthy?
Oh, definitely not. In fact, you could argue that it's not just a relationship, it's collusion. Most governments have seen that their political interests coincide with the interests of the major corporations. And they see the role of the state basically is to promote the interests of those corporations based on a very faulty premise of a kind of trickle-down benefits to working people. And that's the reason why you have very lax regulations, very loose tax codes, which will allow corporations to get away with paying their fair share of taxes. And the other thing I would make about Davos, I think the real driving force behind pursuing particular interests are these institutions that were established after the Second World War, International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and latterly the World Trade Organization. And they all basically pursue an agenda which benefits the major transnational corporations.
How on earth, in the so-called democracies, do we people get a look in, Ron?
That's a very good question. I don't think we get a look in. You know, that's the whole thing. These institutions are being constructed as a way to shield them from popular pressure. They're clearly anti-democratic. The International Monetary Fund, in particular, is based on the financial contributions made by particular nations, and disproportionately the United States has an influence over the IMF's policies.
Does it make any difference that you've got some people like Guterres, UN Secretary General there, Kristalina Georgieva, who's from the IMF? Some of these international institutions are there too. They're not just companies, and they're not just presidents and prime ministers.
That's true. But if you look at the international institutions, and particularly the United Nations, you could question how effective they are in carrying out their remit. At the end of the day, these international institutions were constructed not to prevent individual countries, the major powers, from pursuing their national interests. And the classic example is the United States, which basically acts very unilaterally, often looking for a multilateral cover to justify its actions. But at the end of the day, they will not allow any international institution basically to define what their national interests are.
Well, before we get on to look at Yemen and Gaza, let's just look for a moment to the United States, because we've had these meetings in Iowa. I think they're called the caucuses. Can you just explain a little bit about how this works in the run-up to the U.S. presidential election later this year, Ron?
You think about the primary system?
Yeah, I don't actually understand really how it works. The idea is to pick a candidate, isn't it, for each of the main parties?
Exactly right. I mean, in principle, they're supposed to be testing grounds for the viability of a particular candidate. So rather doing this behind closed doors or even at a convention, which may not be, we still might be open, but only open to certain delegates, the idea is to test the viability of a candidate. So you have a primary system which allows, in most states, only people who are registered in that party. So the New Hampshire primary, only Republicans will possibly be able to register, Republicans will be able to vote. In other states, you may even have an open primary. I think it's Wisconsin, which allows anyone to vote for a candidate. But the primary system is a system that is still fraught with difficulties, and that is that it doesn't necessarily in itself define who the candidate will be. So that you have, for example, the Democratic Party has what they call superdelegates. And the superdelegates are made up of Democratic senators and congressmen and women. So in 2016 and 2020 possibly, 2016 would probably be the best example. Sanders had done much better than Clinton in most of the primaries. But at the convention, he did not have the backing of the Democratic Party establishment, that is the senators and congressmen and women. So that tilted the balance. Trump, meanwhile, benefited from a much more open system. He didn't have to get the support of Republican senators and congressmen and women. In fact, he was seen as an outlier in 2016. Let's put it this way. If Sanders had run under the Republican system of selecting a candidate, he would have been the candidate. And if Trump had to run for the Republican nomination under the Democratic Party system, he would not have gotten the nomination in 2016. So that makes it even more complicated.
Thank you very much. Let's let Nigel Farage give his take on it, because he's been over there and he popped up on Peston to discuss it. So let's have a little listen now to the president, I think he is, or something, or major shareholder or whatever, in Reform UK, the outlying right-wing party which is trying to harry the Conservatives, whose leader is Richard Tice. He was talking on the Peston show. Nigel Farage on Trump this week.
What is so interesting about Iowa? Two things that contrast amazingly with Westminster politics and UK politics today. Number one, to go out and attend the caucus, to see people arriving in ridiculous temperatures, horrific road conditions, turning up. I went to a gymnasium, a school gymnasium. Hundreds of people turned up. They listened to speeches on behalf of the candidates. They voted. They accepted the result. It was a wonderful exercise in real democracy. Your vote in America matters. And the other fascination is this. The clear majority of Iowan elected politicians at state level, including the governor, publicly backed Ron DeSantis. Many of the great and the good in the Republican movement and the biggest donors backed Nikki Haley. And yet, why did Donald Trump get this amazing, historic vote? Because under an open primary system, the people have their say and they can beat the elites, they can beat the establishment. And I tell you something, if the British Conservative Party today had a series of caucuses around the country to choose who the next leader should be, it wouldn't be Rishi Sunak. In fact, I doubt it would be anybody in the current cabinet.
Would it be you?
Whether it be me or somebody else, I'm not going to speculate. But honestly, I saw this with my own eyes. Grassroots politics, democracy matters, producing a result completely different to that that would be produced under the British system today. Our democracy feels dead. People are asking themselves, what's the point in voting at the next election? What's the real difference between these two parties? They're both forms of big state social democracy. It was invigorating to see it, and it really makes me keener than ever to have a wholesale reform of how we do British politics.
Well, that's the leader of the Reform Party. Well, he's not officially the leader. He's a sort of number one shareholder in Reform, Nigel Farage, there speaking on Peston earlier this week. What do you make of his analysis, Rob?
Well, I think what he's overlooked very conspicuously is the role of money in the American political system. The problem of adopting anything like the American political system, you have campaigns that run for over a year. One of the virtues of the British political system is that we have relatively short campaigns. You don't have the election fatigue. Again, United States, even to run for Congress, you need millions and millions of dollars in your treasury. You know, if you're running for president of the United States, I mean, Trump was raising money from the day he lost the election in 2020 for another run of the presidency in 2024. 4 years of raising money. I think he's a bit sanguine looking at the American political system. He is right, though, that in some sense, it allows candidates who might not have been seen as being a viable alternative, basically to surface. And it does give the electorate a greater opportunity to evaluate and possibly reject or support a particular nominee. So that's it. But I think I think he's just painted the situation too optimistically and has not looked at the pitfalls.
Martin?
Yeah, well, I mean, as I understand it, Ron will correct me if I'm wrong, the primary system only really developed from the 1960s onwards, didn't it? It was part of the rebellion against conventions which were fixed and all the rest of it, and things done behind closed doors. And of course, that's what allowed Jimmy Carter to come through in the Democratic primary, because nobody had heard of him, you know. He was a minor peanut farmer that nobody had heard of. So that was part of what you might call opening the system up. But I think the system is closed because the state decides what the political parties are you can be in. You are a registered Democrat or a registered Republican or a registered independent. And that means that the state, in fact, is in charge of what parties are. And you're already being told what you can and can't do. And which is why when they've rigged the primaries in the Democratic nominations with Bernie Sanders, that's really anti-democratic, because if you're going to have an official party that you've got to be a member of and they can't set up a third party, then having a democratic election in that party is crucial for choosing the candidate. Of course, in other countries, anybody can set up a political party, and then you've got to actually stand in the election, which is a proportional election, as in Germany, or they don't have a proportional election in France, but they have two rounds, so you can be sure that whoever won got most votes. The British and American systems are, in fact, 18th century systems, which were originally designed in both cases to entrench oligarchic power. It was an explicit goal of the US Constitution. And this is what, as we saw in 2016, Hillary Clinton got more votes than Trump, but Trump was the man who won because he won more states. Every vote in a state goes to the majority in that state, and all the minority votes are discounted. This is and of course the Senate has got two senators for every state. Tiny Delaware has two senators, and so does enormous California. These are all not bugs, they are features designed to prevent outright democratic rule. And that's how it was originally conceived. And then it's been gradually reformed. You know, black people were given the vote, then women were given the vote. But the basic structure of the system is to ensure oligarchic power. And that's also true in Britain as well, of course. We are, you know, the American system is a version of the British system. But they're all actually non-democratic. You know, if you were to judge them, are they democratic? The answer would be no. They're not, because often, as happens in this country, at the last election, the Tories got 43% of the vote and an 80-seat majority. And that's designed. It's not accidental.
Ron?
Well, I think also we have to keep in mind that Trump has a great deal of support among the established Republican Party. It's not just registered Republican voters at individual states that support Trump. There are many congressmen and women who are loyalists to Trump. They basically, even before this nomination process began, even when Trump was sitting president, they were protecting him from all kind of allegations of impropriety. So I think to argue that there's a dichotomy between the political establishment and the rank and file voters in the United States, I think, is just wrongheaded.
There have actually been impeachment hearings over the last few weeks against Joe Biden, too. I don't know if you've been following that, Ron, but there's certainly been very little reporting of it over here.
Yes, I haven't been following it. It's even the New York Times basically has been putting that, giving it a very low profile.
The reason I asked the point is because all these attempts to prosecute Trump seem to be backfiring spectacularly, but they still keep coming. Every time there's another prosecution, he stands there and says, "Hey, I'm standing. It's not really trying to prosecute me. They're trying to prosecute you." And he actually has done an amazing job. And well, I always remember him saying, "These prosecutions are energizing me." You know, he's actually gaining enormously politically from them.
Well, I don't think they've been backfiring, actually, because we're only looking at among the stalwarts, the most loyal elements within the Republican Party behind Trump. Looking at the the larger political landscape within the United States. I'm not quite sure of if people are going to vote for someone who might be a felon. And I think the one case that I don't think he's going to be able to squirm out of very easily is the case in Georgia. Because that attorney, the district attorney of the state of Georgia, has played her cards very well. She already has three defendants who basically have agreed to cooperate with the prosecution and can provide evidence to convict Trump. And that is a state case. He cannot pardon himself. If he's elected president of the United States and is convicted, it will be a constitutional crisis. How can you have a sitting president who's been convicted of a felon? And I think many voters actually would be, seriously considering, I'm going to risk voting for someone who's likely to be convicted of a felonious crime. So I don't think you could argue that the cases are backfiring on the prosecution. I think it's just Trump is very cleverly using it to whip up support within his base. But his base is not necessarily the general electorate.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I do look at the whole situation. I think, well, why are they bothering? Because, I mean, well, what do you think it would look like? I think as if Trump is likely to win later this year.
That is possible. Biden's popularity is at the lowest level since he's been elected president. I think what you're raising is quite possible.
And we could have roughly coinciding general election here and presidential election in the States. That's very rare.
Yes, exactly right. Yeah.
What are your thoughts on the general election here then? This race between Rishi Sunak and who's really, I see him not as a conservative. I see him as a man from Goldman Sachs, personally. and Starmer. What do you make of that race?
Well, Farage's characterization of the Conservatives and Labour being two social democratic parties, I think, is out to lunch. if anything, both of the parties basically are not social democratic. They basically, I mean, Labour has turned its back on social democracy. The way I look at both parties are trying to have adopted a very cautious approach. We have a term. I'm going to use an American football parlance. Most political leaders, particularly at the national level, basically play their cards very, very closely. In American football, you have 100 yards, all right? And you could be very ambitious and try to move the ball down the field, all right? Or you could basically try to move it very incrementally and just play a very position game and not being very daring in your politics. And I see Labour and Conservative acting that way. Labour in particular has not adopted any bold program. And in fact, they turned their back on the manifesto in 2019, despite Starmer's pledge when he was running for party leader, that he was not going to turn his back on the pledges made by the Labour Party. And one by one, they're biting the dust. And the Conservatives basically just going back to the old playbook, tax cuts, basically cutting back on benefits to the most needy people. You have a very uninspiring political situation in this country, even less so than the United States.
Yeah, yes, you're probably right there. Martin, I'll just give you the final word on Trump and what you think. And that there will be a coinciding general election in the UK and presidential election later this year in the States.
I think the election in Britain is likely to be sort of October. And of course, it'll be before what happens in the States. So it may be that what happens here has some kind of influence in the States. It's a fantasy that British people have. I think Trump may win because it's such a rigged system. I mean, all these arguments about whether he did or did not be cheated in 2020. It was only arguing that he'd won the swing states. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's no, I mean, what's happening in the US demographically is that the big cities still dominate. You know, that's where people live. You know, it may be well that the people in Wyoming are quite conservative, but, you know, you could fit all the people in Wyoming into one suburb of New York, you know. And, of course, over time, it's also the demography's changing because people are coming in and they're getting, you know, becoming citizens and so on. And it's a real problem for the Republicans and the same with the Tories here. Most of their voters are over 55, yeah? Nobody under 30 is likely to vote for them, although, sadly, people under 30 are the least likely to vote. But, I mean, he could win, but it's the system itself is so rotten. Both Trump and Biden are hucksters. They are probably both involved in criminal activities and have been for years. And this is the way the system has become. Drug money has become secretly behind all sorts of things that go on in America and elsewhere, certainly in Latin America. And, you know, when Clinton, you know, one of the things that they have in the US, that the president can pardon 200 people on their last week in power. And, of course, those are the 200 people who did all the dirty deeds. And Clinton pardoned various drug dealers, and no doubt Trump pardoned his own foot soldiers. I mean, why would you want to have a law like that? Yeah, it just tells you what the system's like, doesn't it?
You look at these general elections, presidential elections, and think, well, actually, the real decisions are being made in some chalet in Davos, certainly not on the live YouTube stream of Klaus Schwab, but somewhere round the back. And these are generally business deals. They're to do with corporate takeover of markets within countries, and those politicians, they're basically selling the people that elect them out. I mean, Ron, you know, you do think, don't you, sometimes that these elections are really more of a pantomime?
Well, I wouldn't go that far. I think Martin was suggesting that the political system in the United States works to Trump's advantage, because both candidates know more or less what states they're going to carry. You know, they just know. I mean, Trump is not going to devote much resources to New York State or California. He knows that they're going to go to the Democrats. He's going to focus, and the entire political machine working on his behalf will focus on swing states: Virginia, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan. Biden took those states in 2020. Trump took those states in 2016. And in some cases in 2016, he won only by 1,000 or 2,000 votes. You know? A narrow majority. He got the Electoral College, which was established by the so-called Founding Fathers. It's a very anti-democratic institution because it rewards the smaller states disproportionately than it does the larger states. So you could win the popular vote, you know, by millions, and still lose the election. You know, you need to have 270 electoral college votes, and if Trump gets that, he doesn't care if he loses by 5 million votes overall among the popular vote. He's in as president. And I think, you know, Trump will basically, if Trump is elected, I think that's likely to happen again.
But surely those at Davos have actually got more power through the financial and market control and capital they wield than these politicians, who seem to be basically hamstrung by debt most of the time, and manipulated by not just by their parties, but by their deep state and by their banking system.
I don't disagree with that, but Trump, see, unlike other candidates, was quote unquote a successful businessman. Actually, he was not very successful. He had, he inherited a great deal of money from his father. But, you know, he has a whole background in business, which basically is a selling point. He says, look, I made it good. And I know how the system works, and I will make sure the system will benefit the American people. You know, that's kind of, you know, the nationalist argument that he makes. But I do agree with you. The real powers behind the throne are not the political figures. They are basically the financial and corporate interests.
Yeah, so I think we should finish this section by looking back at Davos again, which is, to my mind, is where it really happens. Hold up there. It's very difficult to get a protest camp going. You just try it, you know, in the freezing weather. You'd have to have a very good sleeping bag in order to survive for a week. And in fact, the interesting thing about Davos is they are very clever. You have to hand it to them. They're also talking this week about the idea of they like direct action. They think things are going wrong in the world. Some of these capitalists are really making a mess of things. So you should be taking direct action. Of course, what they're really saying is you should be joining groups like Extinction Rebellion. Now, is that, do you think there's a sort of anarchistic streak amongst these mega capitalists and these presidents and prime ministers, Ron?
Well, I don't know what to make of that, basically. It's hard to tell when people make statements of that sort because you don't know what their motives are. You don't know what actually lies behind it. But I don't think they would be anarchists. But basically, you know, the suggestion about direct action is a really strange one made, you know, by people at Davos. That's all I could say.
So give a bit of detail. From being a kid trapped in a storm to walking the halls of power, 31-year-old David Saddington's life was shaped by climate change and climate action in the UK. And he's been invited up to Davos to talk about it all. He's a sort of what Davos is calling an action hero, Martin.
Yeah, well, and you remember when Bono and Geldof used to go to Davos and all the rest of it. They want to present themselves as with it, down with the kids, saving the planet. Yeah, that's the PR. Yeah, that's what it's all about. And of course, when they say these things, that's they're trying to co-opt these potentially subversive forces. And of course, you know, it's arguable that people shouldn't go and, you know, what Bono said at the time is we've got to go and talk to all these powerful people because we're trying to get things done for Africa. And of course, that was the kind of his shtick. But at the end of the day, they're billionaires and he's a millionaire and they're all, you know, doing a show because it's show business, isn't it?
Well, I mean, you do wonder where the funding for these sorts of groups like the Forest Action that he's talking about comes from. And maybe it's even from some of the companies who are there. Anyway, let's move on to look at the whole situation in Yemen and Gaza. Well, I think probably the best thing is to look at Yemen first. Before we hear from Judith Brown, who's our sort of local Yemen expert, who's been over in the Gulf this week, but I managed to track her down earlier today. What do you make of this, Ron? I'm very surprised to see the British bombing Yemen, and also that there doesn't seem to have been any attempt to get the British to ask the British Parliament beforehand.
I don't know why you would say they're surprised. Actually, the UK is working in concert with the United States, they are basically pursuing a course of action that basically once again is reminding those people in the Middle East of Britain's colonial heritage, so to speak. You have to keep in mind, you know, at one stage, you know, Yemen was controlled by Britain, at least until 1967, I think it was. So it's not surprising, and Britain is acting in conjunction with the United States because they're not necessarily even trying to protect Israel. I think they're trying to protect certain commercial interests which are being hampered by the Houthis' attempt basically to target those ships that are bringing goods to Israel as a way of pressuring the world community to support an immediate ceasefire.
What do you think of their tactic?
Well, the tactic is a very interesting one because I think, you see, the Houthis basically are acting in solidarity with the people who basically who've been isolated. The Palestinian population, despite the rhetorical support they receive from certain Middle East regimes, those governments have not done anything concretely to really assist the Palestinians in a period of their dire need. And the Houthis are taking some action. And the action is very interesting because the action is not resulting in the deaths of anybody on ships. They're not targeting the UK military or the United States military, but the retaliation so to speak, against Houthi action is resulting in the deaths of Yemenis, which is, you know, it's quite, you know, disparity basically in terms of the results of those actions.
So is it a thumbs up or a thumbs down for the Yemenis?
I think it's a thumbs up.
Let's have a listen now before we hear from Martin on from Channel 4's Gary Gibbon this week, because it was, although the strikes were on Thursday night, which, you know, you could say were probably timed because they knew there were going to be no discussion on Friday, Saturday or Sunday in Parliament about it. In fact, the SNP said that they should recall Parliament if they've decided to declare war on Yemen. So let's have a listen to the discussions and debates in Parliament and Gary Gibbon's report on Yemen this Monday.
The Houthis boasting of military capabilities. The US and the UK today said they believe their joint attacks on Houthi targets on Friday had significantly degraded the Houthis' ability to strike shipping in the Red Sea.
I can tell the House today that our initial assessment is that all 13 planned targets were destroyed. At the drone and cruise missile base in Barney, 9 buildings were successfully hit. A further 3 buildings were hit at Abs Airfield, along with a cruise missile launcher caught in the open. We have seen no evidence thus far of civilian casualties, which we took great care to avoid.
But today it's suspected that a Houthi missile hit a US-owned cargo ship sailing off the coast of Yemen. It follows reports of an attempted cruise missile strike on a US Navy vessel in the Red Sea on Sunday. Rishi Sunak in the Commons would not rule out further attacks on Houthi forces. The difference between past and present Labour leaderships was starkly on display.
Labour backs this targeted action to reinforce maritime security in the Red Sea.
We've had years of bombardment of the people of Yemen by weapons supplied by Britain from Saudi Arabia. And we have this dreadful conflict going on in Gaza where there are 30,000 people dead or missing. Where is the comprehensive plan by the Western nations to try to bring about a comprehensive peace?
Ed Davey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Ed Davey was jeered in his first Commons intervention since he was criticised over the post office scandal. Both the Lib Dems and the SNP said the Prime Minister should have consulted MPs before the UK attacked Houthi targets.
Whilst the Prime Minister has sought to defend his decision not to come to the House last week, it is quite clear that this House should have been recalled. It is what the public would have expected, and I would urge him to do better in future.
And threats from non-state actors.
The Defence Secretary chose today to raise the prospect of much wider military engagements on the not-too-distant horizon.
The era of the peace dividend is over. In 5 years' time, we could be looking at multiple theatres, including Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea. Ask yourself, looking at today's conflicts across the world, is it more likely that that number grows or reduces? I suspect we all know the answer. It's likely to grow.
Let us follow an LNG carrier.
Back in the Middle East, Qatar was reported to be diverting its liquefied natural gas tankers away from the Red Sea, suggesting that 3 days after the US-UK attacks on Houthi bases, they think what Rishi Sunak called limited strikes could have limited effect. And this conflict is not over.
Well, they seem to have laid off for now, Martin, but that is, I mean, you know, it's a little bit, I find it kind of horrifying to say Defence Secretary Grant Shapps. But he's saying, oh, every era of the peace dividend is over. It's time to have wars around here, there and everywhere.
Yeah, it's mind-boggling, isn't it? Of course, there never was a peace dividend in the first place because they basically made sure we didn't get one. What's astonishing to me about this is that it's not actually the Houthis were attacking Israeli registered ships, and as Ron pointed out, they weren't even killing anybody. You know, they were just basically taking one of the main things that they boarded was ship. They took it into port and they impounded it. And in actual fact, most of the ships were going through the Suez Canal perfectly adequately. They closed down the port of Eilat, which is an Israeli port at the head of the Red Sea. And there was no reason at all for the West to intervene in that. It's between the Houthis, if you like, or the Ansar Allah, as they call themselves, and the Israelis. And, of course, the obvious thing that the British and the Americans could do is join everybody else in the world community and say we need a ceasefire, because that's the general position. Of course, in Britain, we're told that that's an unreasonable position and that responsible people don't think like that, apart from France, Spain, China, a whole list of countries who are all saying that the obvious thing to do is have a ceasefire. And don't forget, we've had ceasefires before in Gaza. There has always been ceasefires. There have been various rounds of conflict and they've always ended in a ceasefire. Why not this time? People are asking that question. Why not?
Would you like to answer your own question?
Well, that's because the Israeli state has decided they're going to use this conflict as a means to destroy the Palestinian community comprehensively. Hamas are, in fact, the elected government of Palestine, which is not recognised in the West at all.
Is it also because Netanyahu is in such a very, very fragile political position there? He feels that he's got a fight this external enemy to distract from his domestic woes?
Well, that's part of it, but there's a deeper desire by the deep state in Israel to finish the job of 1948. I'll just point out that the what's happened now as a result of the British and American attack on Yemen is that the insurance companies won't insure anybody to go through the Red Sea. And that's why the Qataris are moving there. The Qataris wouldn't have a problem sending their stuff through the Red Sea. But now they're not going to go there. Maersk won't go there. Commercial companies are not going to send their ships into a war zone because their insurers won't allow it. Now, they were allowing it before.
Well, I mean, it seems the Red Sea is just going to be a kind of parking bay, Ron, for British and American warships.
That's possible. But I think Martin's hit the nail on the head. I think the Houthis would probably have accomplished what they wanted to, basically, and that is to deter shipments to Israel. If more and more shipping companies are pulling out and they're saying, well, we're not going to do that, we're not going to risk losing our cargo, we can't get insurance, it's not in our economic interest to continue, the Houthis might basically now figure, well, we'll just lay low now. I'm not quite sure, and I think the braggado, so to speak, of the defense minister saying that they've basically have made, 14 sites not workable, so to speak, I think is an exaggeration, because the reports I've seen from the New York Times and the Guardian is suggesting that Houthi's military capability to strike back is still very much intact. So they have not been impaired at all by these by the military attacks by the United States and Great Britain.
We're going to be hearing from Judith in a minute. Her Yemeni friends are telling her that all these missiles are on mobile launchers, and when they were hit last week and at the weekend, what happened was actually they were hitting bases, but they weren't actually hitting the missiles or their launchers, because they're all the Yemenis have been predicting this sort of thing for years and they're well prepared for it all. Anyway, let's have a listen now and this is almost going back to discussing Davos, as we were earlier on, to Cameron talking about all this, our good old former Prime Minister and now made Foreign Secretary, on the day after Remembrance Sunday, where it seems the British establishment make sure they don't remember anything about preventing wars by appointing Cameron, making him a lord, as King Charles did on Monday morning. I mean, I just have to reiterate that seeing them all marching from the cenotaph on Remembrance Sunday, that is to say, King Charles followed by Rishi Sunak, followed by David Cameron, into the Foreign Office to have lunch. And then to hear the next morning it's announced that Cameron is Foreign Secretary. I think that's the way this country is being run right now. Charles has said, can we have this guy, put this guy in charge? He's very good. I know him very well. And that's how it seems to be working now. Very different to when the Queen was alive. So I think when people came out to mourn the Queen in their hundreds of thousands, they were marking a very, a passing of an era, which is now gone. So let's have a listen anyway to David Cameron, and we'll hear from Ron and Martin afterwards at Davos, talking about British action in the Red Sea. He is, after all, now, amazingly, Foreign Secretary, along with Grant Shapps as Defence Secretary.
Obviously, you've got to look at all of these different things that are happening in the Middle East. I think the important thing is to try and deal with each of them. I don't think it was possible to go on allowing these attacks to continue in the Red Sea. But at the same time, yes, of course we want to work towards a resolution of the situation in Gaza. I've been very clear that should involve an immediate humanitarian pause. We need to get aid in. We need to get hostages out. That requires a pause. And of course, we've talked about a sustainable ceasefire, because you've got to get rid of Hamas and its ability to rain down terror on Israel. But the best outcome would be moving from that pause to a sustainable ceasefire without a return to hostilities, without more destruction. But for that to happen, a number of things would have to take place. We'd have to see the Hamas leadership come out of Gaza. You'd have to see the hostage situation being resolved and resolved very rapidly. You'd have to make sure that Hamas was no longer capable of doing rocket and terrorist attacks onto Israel. You'd have to start working out who's going to govern Gaza and how, a new Palestinian authority. So, but I think that should be the ambition. That should be the plan, moving from an immediate cessation to deal with hostages, which is a pause, and moving from that into a sustainable ceasefire.
Whether it's Hamas, whether it's Lebanese Hezbollah, whether it's Houthis, all of these roads lead to Tehran. Where is going to be the Western response to Iran?
Well, we have delivered very tough messages to Iran, including I had a discussion with the foreign minister last week. And obviously there's a number of sanctions and other measures already in place. But I think it's absolutely vital that we send a very clear and unequivocal message to Iran that its behavior in supporting these proxies, whether it's Hamas or Hezbollah or indeed the Iranian armed groups in Iraq and Syria, its behavior is unacceptable, and we need to make sure that there will be consequences for this behavior in terms of sanctions.
But as clear as, say, actually striking a leadership like Qasem Soleimani?
No, I think what we need to look at is all the tools that we have in the toolbox. And obviously we have been using, for instance, sanctions against a number of people in Iran, and we need to look at how we can step that up if this behavior continues.
Well, I didn't know David Cameron had his little assassination toolbox over in Davos. But Martin, what do you make of that?
Well, it's just, basically I'm disgusted that the British position. I shouldn't be. I've lived long enough to realise how appalling they are, but I just feel ashamed of it. We should not be attacking Yemen, which, as Ron pointed out, used to be a British colony. They all remember that, even if people in Britain have forgotten it, and people in the US never knew it. And, of course, we've been fighting a war against the people of Yemen with the Saudis for the last 10 years. British military personnel are embedded with the Saudi military. The Saudi military gets its planes, which kill the children in Yemen, from Filton up the road here. That's where they get all their stuff from. And you know, the other thing that strikes me about the whole thing is, why have the French, for example, not joined in? Why haven't the Germans joined in? It's just the British and the Americans and a list of people, like Canada and Bahrain is the only Middle Eastern country to join in this attack. Saudi Arabia hasn't joined in, because they're trying to settle things down with the Houthis. And, of course, the government of Bahrain was a British colony till 1971. And then we imposed the Khalifa family, who are Sunnis, on the population, who are largely Shia. And when they rose up against their tyrant government in 2011, the Saudis invaded with tanks and killed loads of people and bulldozed the Shia mosques. We are doing that. People in the Middle East do not think of us as the good guys. And they're right, because we ain't. When are we going to stand up? They talk about these Iranian proxies. The Israelis are proxies for the British and the Americans. We are supplying the weaponry which they are using to kill the children in Gaza. We are doing that. Now, at what point do we have to take responsibility for our proxies? Now, if you see this from the other side of the glass, from the way people in the Middle East are seeing this, they are seeing the same old imperial powers, which have tried to bully their way around the Middle East since the World War One, still killing our children. At what point do we fight back? And I think that the Nasrullah, I'll call them that, because that's what they call themselves. Houthis is like calling them the Mau Mau or something, or the VC. They have been under bombardment by the Saudi Royal Air Force, helped by the British Royal Air Force for 10 years, and they've thrashed them because they know how to disperse. They haven't got any things that you can bomb. They know exactly how to deal with air attacks. And, of course, these ships which are propped up against their coast are absolutely vulnerable. And maybe this is only going to come to a head when the British ship, if I was the Nasrullah leadership, I would be looking to sink HMS Diamond. Because what's happened now is because the Yemeni military have been killed, they killed 10 in two boats and then they killed 5 with these airstrikes. If 20 British soldiers were killed, we would call that a meet. You know, at that point, we'd start fighting back, wouldn't we? If it was in the channel, they're going to fight back. And, of course, they're able to sink these ships. They need to get them out of there.
Martin, don't you think that HMS Diamond is actually sitting there as bait? I think it's a little bit cruel to these Royal Navy sailors.
Well, it is sitting there as bait, you know, in a way. But, of course, the Yemenis have made it clear we would welcome a war with the United States because the United States has been bombing our country for the they've said it. We want a war with the United States. We're not scared of one. We want it. Bring it on. That's what they're saying. So the idea you're going to deter them by a few pinprick airstrikes is absurd. And the ships, the geography is absolutely against the imperialist powers here. Because if they've got their ships up close to the shore where they have them, they're absolutely vulnerable. They need them out into the Indian Ocean if they want to keep them afloat.
The Yemenis don't have to do anything, do they? They don't have to sink these ships. They've won.
Well, no, that's true, and they're not going to do anything stupid. But they've already started shooting at British and American ships. The things have been shot down, but they've started shooting at them. They said, you can't kill our armed forces, people. We've given them all martyrs' funerals. Now you can have some martyrs' funerals, because we're not
so
scared of this stuff.
Is, of course, if any helicopter, for example, takes off from the ship, that might not make it anywhere. Anyway, Ron, before we hear from you, I'd like to just play... and of course, you're welcome to comment on anything that Cameron said. But I'd like to hear from a guy called James Carteridge, who's a defence minister, who was interviewed. This was in Parliament. That's right. Let's have a listen to him. His name's James Carteridge, and he's the UK defence minister. He was asked about, is Britain at war with Yemen?
Well, I've been speaking to the defence minister, James Carteridge, and I asked him if the UK would now retaliate over the latest Houthi attacks.
I understand there are reports of a potential missile strike in the Red Sea. Obviously, we are part of the patrol, Operation Prosperity Guardian, in the Red Sea, and we will be analysing that information with our allies. But that is something which is ongoing at the moment.
Right, but if there are more attacks, then what happens?
Well, I'm not going to speculate on what happens in the future. I think that, as the Prime Minister made clear, we are committed to protecting the security of our people and indeed of our ships. And as you will be aware, we've been absolutely clear. The reason we undertook that action in the Red Sea, deploying the Royal Air Force, was, as we see it, an act of self-defence because a Royal Naval ship, HMS Diamond, had been attacked, together with, of course, international shipping. So we do stand ready, but to be clear, at the moment, there are no specific plans for further attacks.
No, I understand about specific plans, but I mean, we would look ridiculous if we did nothing now, wouldn't we? I mean, you started this and they're carrying on.
As I say, I mean, I can't speculate on what happens in the future. We are continuing to patrol in the Red Sea and keep a watchful eye on things, liaising with our allies. I think it's the right thing to do.
Totally understand that, but you can't have thought that one round of airstrikes would stop the Houthis, did you?
Well, obviously, we've undertaken this action. We now see what happens next. As I said to you, we are continuing to patrol in the Red Sea. We are ready to respond. But of course, it depends what happens in the future. And so it's not my job to speculate.
That's Defence Minister James Carteridge talking on Channel 4 News. Ron?
Well, I'm going to make a larger point, basically, looking at the situation somewhat differently from where Martin... I don't disagree with anything where Martin was saying, but I think what we're talking about is militarism. a militarism that's not just unique to the UK or the United States. It's within all the NATO countries. I think it's, in some respects, an outgrowth of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. If you look at the increase in military spending on all the NATO countries, it's gone through the roof since that invasion. The bellicose rhetoric we're hearing from U.S. and U.K. Political leaders, I think, is emblematic of this militaristic policy. I think the U.K. is deliberately trying to provoke the Houthis by stationing military vessels off the coast of Yemen, just as the United States is, and I think they would love an excuse basically to go full scale against the Yemenis. I would think that the Houthis might be a bit more clever and not rise to that bait and not to engage in any other so-called provocative military action against the UK or US military forces. But I want to make a comment about what Cameron was saying. I think this is very indicative of the attitude within the West. Basically, it's echoing Israel's position. We got to get rid of Hamas. Hamas is the problem. Sustainable ceasefire. He was talking out of both sides of his mouth. First, he's saying Hamas has to go, but then he says we have to reduce, or we have to prevent Hamas from having the military capability of attacking Israel again, which is quite different from destroying Hamas. But there was nothing about what Israel has to do. How do you have a sustainable ceasefire unless you address the underlying reasons why Hamas conducted that military operation on the 7th of October? You know, it's all missing from the Western media. It's all missing from the Western governments. There's no acknowledgement of the systematic oppression of the Palestinian people, which has been going on at least for 75 years. And in the case of Gaza, maybe looking at it more in a short term, at least since 2006 when Hamas was elected as the government of Gaza. So Gaza's been under siege since 2007. There have been attacked six times by the IDF before 2023. So it's the context is missing. There's no recognition of the context of why this situation has exploded. If you recognize the history of Palestine and Israel, you would not be surprised that Hamas took action on the 7th of October. Now, I recognize under international law, people living under occupation have the right to resist. I don't think the resistance of Hamas conducted on the 7th of October is ethical resistance. What I mean by that, you don't attack innocent civilians. You attack those people who are oppressing you, which is the military or government officials. You do not attack innocent civilians. But that the events of the 7th of October does not justify Israel's onslaught. And I would say, at least domicide, making Gaza so unlivable for the majority of people living in Gaza, and some would even argue genocide.
Well, that's being discussed, isn't it? Down in, we ought to mention that, Ron, down in The Hague.
Exactly. And it's very interesting. The International Court of Justice, which South Africa basically has appealed to assess its case that they presented about the genocide being conducted by Israel, has been supported by about 20 states, all from the global south. There's not one nation, not one government from the global north that basically has supported South Africa's position. And if you look at the list of the countries in the global south that have supported South Africa's position, they all have experienced colonialism, a colonial rule at one stage in their history, or have experienced imperialist interference or intervention more recently. So it's very, it just shows the power dynamics on the international level and the real cleavage basically still that exists basically between the imperial powers or the former colonial powers and the former colonized peoples.
Well, it's a fair bet to say that everyone who was involved in setting up the Genocide Convention back in the 1940s is dead now, Ron. Do you think the ICJ is up to the job? Can they deliver the goods after the Holocaust and the Genocide Convention, which was set up after World War II by those that had experienced it?
That's a very fundamental question. I observed a webinar conducted yesterday in Washington, D.C., among the, it's called the Arab Center in Washington, and they had a whole number of international law experts who were talking about the International Court of Justice. I think the Court of Justice might be up to it, but I'm not quite sure if the United Nations Security Council is, because the real problem is the Court of Justice could agree with the provisional measures that South Africa is called for, i.e. particularly immediate ceasefire. But who's going to enforce it? Right? They don't have to issue a decision immediately whether or not Israel's actions constitute genocide. They could just recognize the severity of the situation and say, yes, a ceasefire is called for. But who's going to implement that? If it goes to the Security Council, you could bet your last pound that the United States will veto that. And well, then what?
The way these things can work is that those countries which are signed up to the Genocide Convention, and it may be that they have some sort of choice as to whether to do it or not, but they can consider that a legal decision in their own jurisdiction. And so anybody that is named as somebody that's been involved in that or a supporter of it from anywhere around the world, as soon as they enter that country, they'll be arrested.
Well, that's different. The International Criminal Justice, International Court of Justice is different from the International Criminal Court. The International Criminal Court, if they issue a finding, you're quite right, that anyone who has basically been complicit, let alone basically been carrying out genocide, would be subject to arrest. But the International Court of Justice works a little differently, I'm afraid. But what this actually points out to, basically, is the whole fragility of the international system that was established after the Second World War, basically to adjudicate disputes and find a way basically to promote some kind of just solution between so-called warring parties. It seems like right now the international system is basically tottering. That's the way I would describe it.
Well, yes, the Israelis have brought it to the brink. So let's listen to Dr. Judith Brown now. It's a longer interview with her. It's been about half an hour, where she goes into a lot of detail about the history of Yemen and its strategic importance, and also about the character of its government. Really, the Houthis aren't the Houthis or Ansar Allah. They are the government of Yemen, the military of Yemen. And the idea that they're terrorists, which apparently the British and the Americans have decided this week that the entire government, the military of Yemen are terrorists, is just a way of saying that we don't like you and we would like a war with you, it seems to me. But anyway, let's have a listen to Dr. Judith Brown as I asked her about the rights and wrongs of the Yemenis trying to use the Bab al-Mandeb Strait at the bottom of the Red Sea at the south end with the Suez Canal at the north end in order to control trade to and from Israel.
The British position is a very difficult position. Yemen considers itself a signatory to the, it is a signatory to the Genocide Convention. Since it unified, it's made a recommitment to that, to the Genocide Convention, and considers that there's a genocide happening in Gaza and that it has a duty as a signatory to the Genocide Convention to actually do what it can to stop that genocide. the seas around the Bab el-Mandab, which ships come through, is actually Yemen coastal waters. It's not open seas. It's Yemen coastal waters. So Yemen has said that through its coastal waters, it's not going to allow any ships that are bound for Israel to actually pass through those waters until the Israelis allow sufficient humanitarian aid and food into Gaza. So its position is absolutely clear. This is its Yemeni territorial waters. It's not open seas. Normally, when boats pass through those territorial waters, they actually are charged money, which goes into the Yemeni coffers. Yemen, because it's territorial waters, it can control who goes through those territorial waters legally. And what it said is no ships that may be supporting the genocide are going to be allowed through until we have evidence that the genocide has actually ended. So to me, that's a very sort of like moral position. I can't argue with it at all. And yet Yemen has been very blackened by the fact that it stopped boats going through its territorial waters for the first time ever. It's never ever done this before, so it's not part of an irrational thing going on. This is a sort of like a rational episode, and of course it's actually stated if food and humanitarian aid goes into Gaza, it'll allow Israeli boats through. So it's very clear.
Ron, do you want to just respond to that? I mean, I know we've really been talking about this, but what she's saying there is actually there are legal reasons why the Yemenis believe that they're quite entitled to do this under the Genocide Convention.
Yes, and I that's the reason why before, when you asked me, did I give the thumbs up or the thumbs down to what the Houthis were doing, I said I gave the thumbs up, because there is a way of putting pressure on the international community to recognize the barbarism of the attack on RDF on Gaza. The so-called war on Hamas is not a war against Hamas. It's a war on the Palestinian people. The other ones are really suffering. But I think her point about the territorial waters, is a valid point. But I think what the United States and Britain are trying to do, basically, is try to provoke the Houthis into a wider conflict. And basically use that as an excuse to maybe even invade Yemen. And that's why I said before about the Houthis have been very careful not to rise to debate that the United States and the UK have planted, so to speak, off the coast of Yemen.
Right, so let's hear a second clip from Judith, in which she looks at the way that when Ukraine kicked off back in 2022, the 8-year, 9-year long war between Saudi Arabia, British sponsored and American sponsored, and Yemen petered out. So let's have a listen to that now.
Well, funnily enough, a month after the start of the war on Ukraine, Saudi Arabia unconditionally stopped bombing Yemen, which made me think that the West wasn't able to supply sufficient weapons to both Ukraine and Saudi Arabia at the same time. There have been peace negotiations, and when Oman was undertaking these as a sovereign country, they were going quite well. But then America sent a peace envoy there, and since then they've gone a bit upside down, and they haven't been conducted so smoothly. So there's no official peace between Saudi Arabia and Yemen. But quite interestingly, UK and USA asked Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates to restart their bombing campaign in Yemen, and both of those countries refused. obviously UAE now has diplomatic relationships with Israel, but it's actually being quite strongly critical of Israeli actions in Gaza and very supportive of the South Africa's filing a complaint of genocide at the International Court of Justice, and both countries have been very influential in both the 57 Islamic states and in all of the nations in the Arab League, and actually both of those organizations are supporting the South African genocide complaint. So rather than supporting Israel and the and UK and USA, they've actually took a very definite stand in not supporting them. They certainly they've decided that they're not going to implement a war at the behest of US and UK in Yemen.
What about this idea of saying the Houthis are a terrorist organization? I mean, surely they are actually now just the government of Yemen. And so by proscribing them, I mean, there's a certain absurdity to calling them a terrorist organization.
Absolutely.
It's a little bit like calling the whole of Russia a terrorist organization.
Absolutely, it is. But of course, terrorist, it simply means somebody that disagrees with you in terms of UK and American policy. So they just have a different political agenda, and the word terrorist and terrorism really are meaningless. There's no real legal agreement on what those terms mean. So therefore, they can say it about any group that they want to. But of course, that has political implications. Whether in fact other countries agree with that and don't prescribe the Houthis as terrorist organizations, that means that they can continue to operate in Yemen and support Yemen if they need to. I think that's an open situation, and I'm not quite sure how it will end.
So do you know, have you any idea what the effect of these strikes has been in Yemen?
One person told me that 5 people had been killed. This was 2 days ago, and I haven't heard since. I haven't spoken to anyone for the last 2 days. One person told me that no one had been killed, and one person told me that 5 people have been killed. I did read on the internet that no people had been killed. So, and that was 2 days ago. I haven't had news yesterday or today yet. But I think that the difficulty is most of the missile bases that they've got in Yemen, they're really sophisticated weaponry that they've got, and very precision missiles. But they're all mobile. None of them have definite bases. So therefore, they're very difficult for there isn't a lot of intelligence inside Yemen supplying US and UK with information relating to targets, and they've got mobile missile stations. So I think
they'll be using satellites, surely.
Who? Yes, they definitely will be using satellites. Yes, but it's difficult for them to pick out because the missiles are all mobile. They shoot missiles for they're not in fixed positions. The missile launchers are mobile, so therefore they can be moved.
That's Dr. Judith Brown, and I'll put the full version of the interview with her from today. She's over in Dubai, in the UAE, just around the corner from Yemen, literally. I'll put that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Do you want to comment on the geopolitics of this, Martin? This whole thing of, it's almost like the eye of Sauron has moved from Yemen over to Ukraine, and therefore the West hasn't got enough arms to help, or money to help, the Saudis to kill Yemenis, and so it's going to help the Ukrainians kill Russians instead.
Well, I think that there obviously there is linkages between all these conflicts, and everything's connected to everything else, but there are also specific conflicts. I mean, I think the Saudis realise that they're just getting their backside handed to them by the Nasrallah movement, and that MB Mohammed bin Salman, whatever else you may think of him, he's somebody who wants to actually pull Saudi Arabia out of being dependent on oil. He wants to develop a more diverse economy, and for that, and that's why he agreed under Chinese suggestion to normalise relations with the Iranians.
Martin, it's not really what I asked you.
No, I know.
Ron, you'd like to address the question. It's almost as if the West can only really concentrate on one of these things at a time. Once the Ukrainian front opens and the Russians move into Ukraine, they seem to have forgotten about aiding the Saudis to bomb Yemen, and that all eases off over there.
Well, also, the emergency so-called military aid that the United States is providing Israel, in the process... $142 million package was added to already the billions of military aid that the United States gives to Israel. And, Israel has an insatiable appetite for artillery shells, drones, bunker blasters, white phosphorus. You're quite right. The United States has limited military resources. As much as the United States is a superpower militarily speaking, they don't have inexhaustible amounts of resources to provide every country that might be fighting an insurgency or acting in a way that might be consistent with the United States' interests.
We've also this week had strikes by the Pakistanis on Iran. I don't think those would have happened if Imran Khan, the elected president, had still been in charge. Do you want to say, Martin and Ron, something about that? That's a bit out of the blue, that one.
Well, it's certainly a worrying spreading of what's happening, and it just shows you how febrile the atmosphere is. I think you're probably right that if Imran Khan wasn't in prison, he was still the Prime Minister of Pakistan, this would have been sorted out rather differently. Don't forget, the people who are actually running Pakistan are the army, and the army at the end of the day are basically pro-American. So they have basically responded to this Iran, that both of them have problems with Baluchi separatists across the border between Pakistan and Iran. I find it hard to. I tell you, the best analysis I've read of what Iran did this week is from Bhadra Kumar, who used to be a diplomat for India. He's an Indian diplomat. He's retired now, and he's saying what the Iranians are doing with these strikes is showing that they can strike, and therefore, and they could have been much tougher, but they show, because of course they had that big bombing by IS supposedly in Kerman, and they're under pressure internally to do something about that. But, I mean, just as, leaving aside all the geopolitical shenanigans and ins and outs of it, it is an extremely dangerous moment. You know, it's comparable with the run-up to World War One, isn't it, where all these little things are just going bang, 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 and you just think, what's coming next?
I get the impression that the Anglo-Zionist Empire really are annoyed with Iran for so-called supporting the Yemenis, and so they are looking for they're kind of raking around the world because will anyone give these guys a few missiles, and the Pakistani military say yes, so maybe that's just me being a little bit cynical. Have you got anything to say about this, Ron? It's come out of the blue for me. I wasn't expecting it at all. Pakistan hitting Iran and Iran hitting back.
Well, I think I read a piece in Al Jazeera which argues that this, Iran is basically under domestic pressure, political pressure, to basically flex its muscles. It's taken action against supposedly a Mossad base, I think it was in Iraq. They attacked Kurdistan, Kurdish positions in Syria as well. Supposedly retaliating against, there seems to be a link between the bombing of the funeral of the Iranian Republican Guard leader who died a year ago. He was assassinated. And so there was a supposedly link between a Pakistani group, a militant group, and that explosion at the funeral. And that was the so-called motive for the Iranian military attack against Pakistan. I can't really comment any more than that because you're quite right. It was very unpredictable, and it seems to be totally disconnected, it appears to be, with the war taking place in Gaza at the moment.
Well, I mean, I bet you old Jake Sullivan, and he's a national security advisor, who's over in Davos at the moment, the guy who Seymour Hersh indicates as the mastermind of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline being blown up, he's probably rubbing his hands as he sees Islamist rebels attacking Iran. That's his. That's exactly the sort of thing that floats his boat, and you'll probably be drinking to them right now. But anyway, before we're going to get on to the home front now, final item, and which is something called Palestine Action. Here over in the UK, there's quite a lot been going on this week. They are I find fascinating little group. And although not so little, I mean, they're quite split up around the country. So let's just start off with a news report about the stock exchange apparently being targeted by Palestine Action earlier this week.
Well, it's understood that the tip-off came on Friday, Gillian. The Metropolitan Police have had all weekend to try and figure out what to do about it. It followed this, as I say, a kind of a tip-off, some information being unveiled by the newspaper alleging that a number of people belonging to the Palestine Action Group intended to target this building, the London Stock Exchange, tomorrow morning, allegedly to cause damage and to prevent, they say, the building from opening for trading. Now, this is a building in the heart of the City of London, long seen as the most valued stock exchange in Europe. But following that tip-off, a number of arrests have been made this morning, including a man and two women arrested in Liverpool on suspicion of conspiracy to cause criminal damage, including as well another woman and a man from London and another 27-year-old man from Brighton, all believed to have been involved in this same plot. We've heard from Detective Superintendent Sean Thomas from the Metropolitan Police, who has described these as arrests as being significant. She says these are significant arrests. We believe this group was ready to carry out a disruptive and damaging stunt, she said, which could have had serious implications had it been carried out successfully. She also goes on to say in that statement that information that was given by the Express newspaper was instrumental in helping them intervene successfully. So tonight, six people are in custody. We have also heard in the last few moments from the Palestine Action Group themselves.
Yeah, so we're going to hear from Palestine Action in a minute, actually. But what did transpire was five of them were released and one was charged with conspiracy to try and shut down the stock exchange. But in reality, they wouldn't have been able to really have any effect on trading because it's all done remotely. So what do you make of this group and this sort of tactic, Ron?
Well, I think Palestine Action has been very resourceful. They think outside the box. Their initial target is Elbit Systems in this country, and Elbit Systems Israel. And there's overlapping directorships between those two entities. Then they start to target those company, those landlords who provide the property. Lease out the property to Elbit Systems to manufacture arms for Israel. If you give any credibility to this report, now they want to draw a link basically to the larger arms industry within the UK, which obviously could be public limited companies, and they want to draw attention to that. But it's hard to say any more than that, because we don't know how valid the claim was that there was an actual conspiracy. I could say, and I may be going off the point here, and if I am, Tony, just tell me, I've been going to court on a regular basis, the Crown Court, where the Elbit 7, these are seven defendants who broke into Elbit factory at 500 Aztec West, on May 15, 2022. They're undergoing a trial. And it's very interesting. If you look at some of the headlines and social media, I think there's one newspaper, I think it may have been The Express, that had two photos of the two of the seven defendants in their story and made reference to the case taking place now at the Crown Court in Bristol, basically linking the Palestine Action, so-called conspiracy in London, with the action taking place in Bristol. I was very, very concerned about that, because that could jeopardize the ability of the defendants to get a fair trial. I'll leave it to Martin to say a bit more, because I think I already said enough, at least for the time being.
Okay. All right. Well, anyway, look, you're welcome to trot off now if you want, because we've got quite a long report about Palestine Action coming on. It's totally up to you. It's around about 12 minutes long, but it's looking at Nick George's, and his sister was arrested and then de-arrested in her own house earlier this week down in Truro. Because she hadn't got any replies. She'd been writing letters and emails to her MP about Palestine. She hadn't got any replies at all over 3 or 4 months. And so she decided to go down to the MP's office and, with a drawing pin, pin a notice onto her so that the MP would actually see it and might like to reply. She got a visit from the police, allegedly for criminal damage to the door by destroying the drawer with a drawing pin. But we'll be hearing that in a minute. Martin, you can give us your thoughts on what we just heard after we've heard this latest this last report, and maybe you'll be with us afterwards, Ron. Maybe not. It's totally up to you. This is Nick George's sister's arrest, and also his partner Sal has been acquitted for pouring tomato sauce all over the Statue of Balfour in the UK Parliament.
We're moving into the closest to true police state that we have ever been into. It is quite horrific. And just a little side story here. I'm staying with my sister in Cornwall. Woke up this morning. My brother-in-law shouted out, we got some visitors. My sister was in bed. I came downstairs. And there were four policemen in my sister's kitchen. Four huge, great policemen, all fully battened up with body-worn videos, tasers, huge, great batons and everything, all their armour plating. And my poor sister woke up, came down, struggled down in her dressing gown, an old-age pensioner. And they said, right, we've come to arrest you and we're going to search your house. And, you know, you talk about a police state and what? And they are arresting her for criminal damage. And what she'd done... She's trying to write to her MP, Cheryl McCraw, about, who's a Conservative MP, about what's going on in Palestine. And Cheryl McCraw just never answers, no response. Her own MP will not reply to her. And so what she did, she took a drawing pin and a note, a placard, a photograph, and she tapped a drawing pin and pinned this note to Cheryl McCraw's door.
This is my message to my local Tory MP in Truro. She's called Sherilyn McCrory. I've written to her asking her to explain why she backs killing Palestinians, why she backs arms to Israel that enables that to happen. She has never replied to my emails. Everybody that I've spoken to who has written to her has said she doesn't reply to theirs. There we go. And the message at the top says Sherilyn McCrory. Underneath, paid to back genocide, torture, brutality.
And apparently that is criminal damage. She put a drawing pin in a door and the police came down, four of them, two cars, plainclothes car and a police car, to arrest her for doing criminal damage to Cheryl McCraw's door. They searched the whole house. And in the end, finally, she agreed that she would come down to the police station at a future date with a solicitor and be interviewed by them.
I'm just going to explain. Okay, these are very low level offences. Okay, there's damage to a front door of the MP's office in Truro, where damage has been caused. There's been pins put in the door, If April doesn't want to talk to us at all, then we may have to take her to a police station. Tom, she's been arrested. The arrest has been explained to her.
So. And we also don't know what we're up against. So, and we like to sort of, we treat things in a worst case scenario kind of thing as well.
If she is willing to accept that she's damaged the front door to the MP's office by placing placards on there. So, my explanation...
Which is the only thing you've got CCTV for, you say?
We've got CCTV for that.
Okay, so will Cheryl McCrory get that letter?
We have to, because it's from her office. So, yeah, we have
to... So, that's one of the few ways that we can speak to our MP.
I'm not going to get involved in the political side of it.
Because April has tried to speak to her.
I can't, you know, she's your MP, or she's the MP for Truro and Falmouth, and... Yeah. I'm not here for that. People are entitled to free speech and to express themselves in any way. The line that has
then,
to be
then what are you doing here then? Arresting
this lady?
It's
been explained to April, so it's been explained to April.
Criminal damage is why we're here.
We're looking at the damage to the door. And if April's willing to accept, yes, I damaged the door, I'm talking about the door at the moment, then we can use community resolution for that. If we don't, then... We could invite her in as a voluntary attendant to the police station. My colleague said about drawing pins and things like that. I'm not going to look for drawing pins. I'm not going to look for a hammer.
You find something. All sorts of other stuff.
I've already seen there's pins on the wall here. There's pins in your door. There are millions of them, so there's no point in that, all right? Quick scan around. Oh. We've got, like James has explained, we've got powers to search.
Yeah, okay.
So.
And then finally, they did the arrest her and they went away, but. I mean, you talk about a police state, and my poor sister, she was so upset, she literally fainted on the kitchen table in front of them. She was so distressed. And, you know, this is what it's coming to.
Yeah, I mean, this sounds like Gestapo tactics, actually. It sounds like the sort of thing that is designed to threaten and intimidate, but actually they know themselves that it's got no basis in law.
Absolutely. It's got no basis in law. I mean, how it can be criminal damage to put a drawing, now tap a drawing pin into someone's front door who's your MP to try and get your message to her because she won't respond, which is her duty to answer all her letters from her constituents. It's just horrific. And to go down there and see these four hooligans, thugs, intimidating my poor sister who'd literally just woken up and seeing her virtually faint on the kitchen table from the shock of it all, because she put a drawing pin in someone's door. It's just...
Well, in a way, I suppose it's a proud example of what's going on the home front. But do you want to just look for a minute at what's been happening in Gaza? Because it's been, since we first spoke, round about the middle of October, Nick, there's been quite a few developments.
Yes, there have been lots of developments. I think most people are probably aware of the figures. I mean, we quote all these figures because the figures are horrific. But as soon as you've quoted them, they're out of date. Just for those that don't know, I think at the moment there's 25,000 people have been officially registered and logged with their refugee status and numbers as dead. I think it's something like 61,000 people have been injured. There's 15,000 people buried under the rubble. Of those 15,000, there's probably 1,000 maybe are still alive under there and just dying slowly. There's no equipment, no machinery to move to get them out of the rubble. There's over 10,000 children have been killed, and they're the lucky ones. I think it's like another 10,000 children are amputees. They've had legs, arms, and God knows what amputated with no anaesthetic whatsoever. The whole thing is just, I think it's over 1 million people have been displaced. 1 million people made homeless by this unbelievable bombing. It's just what Israel is doing is just horrific. The latest thing I've heard, and not that I'm particularly well informed about it, but apparently Israel has now withdrawn its troops out of northern Gaza. Not because it's withdrawing them for military purposes, but because there is so much disease and the disease is so rampant because there's no water and no food and so many dead bodies there that can't be buried, that a lot of the Israeli troops are dying from disease. So to save their own troops, they're now withdrawing from northern Gaza. And the other reason is they don't need to be there, because in 2 weeks, anybody who's alive there now will be dead anyway. So they're letting the disease do the business for them. They don't even need to be there. And I've even heard stories about babies being fed sewage in an effort to get some sort of sustenance into them. You know, and this is what Israel's doing. And, you know, the whole thing is blatantly clear. There's no question to anyone with any sense. It is a genocide, and it's a serious attempt at ethnic cleansing. It's the ICJ, and it's so appropriate for South Africa to bring this case to the ICJ. If anybody in the world understands about the true meaning of apartheid, it is South Africa. And it's also so brave of them to bring this case to the ICJ, because all those judges, all those people involved in bringing that case against Israel will face the most horrendous abuse. There'll be attempts to bribe them. There will be death threats against them. And they'll pay a huge price personally for trying to do this, take this to the ICJ. And yet it's such an important thing they're doing. It's so humane. It's a wonderful thing. And for the Palestinians, it's one of the first true cases of support for Palestine outside of Palestine. And if you look, I can't remember all the countries off the top of my head, but so many of the countries in the Southern Hemisphere have voted to support South Africa in this ICJ claim. And it really highlights the difference between Europe, the US, and the UK, with its capitalistic and military power, against the South and all these other countries who have seen so clearly what our power, capitalism, financial and military, has done. And they've seen the injustices, the crimes against humanity, and the horrors that our so-called democracy and capitalistic lifestyle is producing. And they don't want it. So you're getting a much clearer divide between the two these two big groups, one half the world and the other half the world. And it's very interesting that Netanyahu, the ICJ, have got all these reported interviews where him, his generals, his prime minister, Herzog, have all been calling to kill the Palestinians, to ethnically cleanse them, to clear them out of Gaza, to massacre them. All these talks have been recorded in an effort to show it is true genocide and what the powers of the Israeli government are doing. And now, all of a sudden, because he's realised that he's being seriously, you know, in trouble now, he's actually retracted it. And he's actually stated that he doesn't want to genocide them, that he doesn't want to ethnically cleanse Gaza. So this is just a little indication of the effect that this court case is having on him. The video of our partner Sal and her friend Gamzee, hopefully you've just seen this video, where they got proper tickets for a tour of the House of Parliament. They went into the House of Parliament very near the anniversary of the Balfour Statement in 1917. And they took some tomato ketchup with them and super glue. And they glued onto the plinth of Balfour's statue inside the House of Parliament, squirted ketchup over Balfour's statue to represent the spilt Palestinian blood that Balfour's statement has caused.
Palestinians have suffered for 105 years because of this man, Lord Balfour. He gave away their homeland, and it wasn't his to give. British complicity never ended. Palestine Action are here to make sure that it does. We're striking here at the heart of Parliament, from here to Elbit's factory, and we won't stop until the Nakba stops.
Free Palestine!
Free Palestine! Elbit then markets their weapons as battle-tested. Their whole business model is built on the destruction of Palestine, built here in Britain and then traded worldwide to kill people. And the British government in 1917, and every single government since, has profited
from these colonial crimes. This statue of Lord Balfour represents the start of Britain's crime in Palestine.
So that's Nick Georges there from Palestine Action with a pretty comprehensive report of just a week or so from Palestine Action. There's loads of other stuff going on as well. Martin, I mean, I've noticed that just yesterday, the cargo contractors for Elbit, this drone manufacturing weapons company, an Israeli company with offices all over Britain, the contractors who do their transport had their entire offices covered with red paint. I mean, literally from top to bottom. They must have got up on the roof as well. There are bits of the paint have been wiped away from some of the windows so that people can actually see out now. But there's very little press coverage of all this, though.
Well, unless it can be spun in a negative direction. Yeah. So, in other words, you know, the suggestion is Palestine Action is, you know, this quasi-terrorist organisation, etc. That's what the Daily Express are obviously, you know, riding their hobby horse about that. But, of course, the other way to deal with things is either to diss them and say how terrible they are or to just ignore them if they're embarrassing enough. And that's also another tactic, isn't it?
Yes, quite right. And we've got this going on right now in Bristol, this Elbit trial. Protesters, though, during this trial here in Bristol have been shutting down the company with an early morning demonstration. So there's a picture of about 40 Palestine Action people shutting down a Bristol company during a demo. The company describes itself as a defence technology and aerospace company working on a range of technologies for military and civilian applications. Part of an Israeli-based company, Elbit Systems, and has contracts with the Ministry of Defence. Disrupting their military supply chain through direct action, that is what Palestine Action has been doing. But then there's also this trial going on here in Bristol, which, it's quite difficult to follow these things in detail simply because when the trial is active, you've got to be careful that you don't steer the jury. So that's been going on too. Also, the London Stock Exchange, yes, one guy has been charged over that, but it would be interesting to see if they get anywhere with that case because, as I said, the BBC admitted that it wasn't actually possible for them to disrupt the stock exchange, even if they did chain themselves to the entrance, because the whole thing is controlled in some sort of remote fashion and it's not possible to physically do that. But anyway, what do you make of this whole tactic of disrupting the supply chain and hitting, for example, companies that own warehouses used by Elbit and are making money from this in one way or another, going and finding all of them and hitting them one by one in the pocket, all with non-violent direct action?
Well, it is to do with non-violent direct action. That's exactly what it is, isn't it? I think what you've got is a mass movement developing on the streets, as we did against the cruise missiles in the 80s, and lots of people would turn up for demonstrations, and then a minority within that group would then take it further to go on and carry out direct actions directly targeting military installations or whatever. It's a well-established division of labour within the radical movement in this country.
That they've even got this guy at Davos saying, be an actionist, a trailblazer's inspiring message to climate activists. But he's saying, that you've got to take action. There's no point in just going on demonstrations. And as you say, if people have gone to three or four demonstrations, they don't see much difference, then, they may be willing to risk arrest, even if it's, maybe to go through non-violent direction action training, etc. So the idea really is to hit the war machine in the pocket.
That's right. And it also creates publicity. Yeah. So you go to court And then, you know, the court system then has to deal with the rights and wrongs of what's going on, and it all, you know, you're using that as a platform to make your case. It's a well-established tactic, and frankly, it makes a lot more sense in this situation in relation to what's going on in Gaza than it does for some Just Stop Oil protester to sit in the middle of the motorway and stop everybody getting to work about a very general, you know, point, and it's a general attack on everybody who's trying to get to work. This is focused stuff, and it's actually, you know, the clock is ticking down. As we are speaking, and we've been on air this evening, Tony, many children in Gaza will have been killed. And, of course, it's not just the indirectly killed. And this is central to what the South African lawyers are saying in The Hague, is the cutting off of food and water and medical supplies and the bombing of hospitals is absolutely clearly aimed at killing the population in general, isn't it? What else is it? It's not. That's not a military operation.
But it's a basic legal principle that says that you can be acquitted if you're trying to prevent a greater crime.
Well, that's no doubt what the lawyers will be arguing. And even if you are acquitted and fined or sent to prison, you've won the moral argument anyway. That's the whole point of doing it like that, isn't it?
Yeah, it certainly is. So, you know, overall, do you think that the tactic used by Palestine Action is going to succeed in putting pressure on to stop the genocide?
Well, I think it's an absolutely legitimate tactic, and I applaud those who are doing it. And you know, and I think they're doing it. They're doing exactly the right thing, and they won't hear a word of criticism from me. You could argue, I'm being a bit naughty here, that it's time to move beyond non-violent direct action, as the Houthis are doing. They're going to sink HMS Diamond. That's not non-violent, is it? That's warfare. But the people we're up against don't claim to be pacifists. They believe in military action.
I'm not sure that they will sink HMS Diamond. I think that, in a way, the Yemenis are sitting there quite enjoying seeing this ship sitting there, not quite sure about what its purpose is, because it's failed to help and allow free travel of Israeli ships and or any other ships, American ships, for example, through the Red Sea.
Well, then, so, now the Anasrullah movement is now saying they were only targeting Israeli-bound vessels, but now British and American-bound vessels are targets. That's what they've said. And they've said, and they've said Chinese and Russian ships will not be attacked. Yeah, so they're upping the ante because they are poker players.
You just run up a different flag on your ship.
Well, the point is that what they've been doing is they've been getting information through open source about which ships are owned by Israeli millionaires and billionaires and so on. And in actual fact, what they say is you've got to convince us that you're not an Israeli ship. Contact us as you come into our waters. Talk to us, convince us you're not going to Israel, and we'll let you through. But the ship that they attacked the other day is an American ship, and it refused to answer when the Houthis said, you know, you're in our territorial waters, we want to have a word with you. Which, of course, is what we would do in the English Channel, you know, and we'd be regarded as absolutely okay, you can do that. But they can't, apparently.
It's almost like they've set up a kind of floating customs post at Aden, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, or yeah, to check you in, a kind of border.
Well, don't forget, as Judith was pointing out, the ships that sail through the Yemeni waters have to pay anyway. You know, they don't just get a free trial, you know, they have to pay to use the waters. So they've all got to register to move, you know, to move around. I mean, what a cheek it is for the British and the Americans to turn up off the coast of another country and tell them what they can and can't do with their coastal waters.
What
if the Chinese started doing that in the Channel?
Yeah, or what about a Yemeni frigate or destroyer sitting out in the mouth of the River Thames? You know, saying you can come past. We're just here to make sure everyone can pass freely. I mean, I think most of the world, even in the Western world, can see there's an element of absurdity to this, Martin.
There is. I don't see. It doesn't make sense from a military point of view. I mean, what Ron was suggesting is that, you know, that this is a provocation, and of course it is, but the Yemenis can't be defeated here. They're not going to be defeated. Even if they were to invade Yemen, Saudi Arabia invaded Yemen with the full support of British special forces. They've been in there with the Saudis fighting the Yemenis, and what they will no doubt tell you is they're really, really tough. Because they've been fighting for 10 years, they've been fighting Saudi Arabia, backed by the US and Britain, and they've beaten them. Because they've got nothing to lose, and they're absolutely courageous. So even if they invaded Yemen, it would just be a disaster for them. So what are they playing at? And I don't think they do know what they're playing at, actually. I think a lot of, you know, the good news is that they are strategically incompetent. That's what the Russian general staff think of them anyway.
And that's not very good for the sailors sitting on HMS Diamond. It's not at all good for them. It seems to me that you've got, what you've got is political leadership in Israel, etc., that's just ordering the military around, and the military don't have the backbone to stand up to them and say, well, this doesn't make any sense.
Well, no, some of the military in Britain and in Israel are also delusionary. You know, they just want to be important, and they like firing missiles off because it makes them feel important.
Okay, anyway, Martin, thank you very much for joining us. We're going to finish up now with a poem from Patrizia Opulenza about Davos, and then a real treat, which is an excerpt from The Occult Experience, a 1985 documentary, where a Satanist tells us all about what she thinks Satanism is really all about. So we're first with Patrizia. Ode to the Davos Crew, 2024. The Davos Crew all lay in wait to destroy our lives, as us they hate. Swab with voice. Seen spitting tacks, slobbered words, more lies unpacked. A pathetic man on stage all saw. A megalomaniac deplored. Podium to Zelensky gave. Is recruiting more for shallow graves. Zell with voice like gravel paper. Burns both ends the candle favours. White dust on shoulder or dandruff sore. A ne'er-do-well ear pushing war. A script to read, no brawn or brain. A puppeteer, a man insane. Next subject was the climate scam. Then bring back trust, the latest sham. MPs on jollies from UK. A bribe, perhaps. But who's to say? One thing for sure, the wealthy lot are full of lies and tricks and rot. Nothing said is ever fair. They live their lives without a care to rule the world with fear and lies, control their game in thin disguise. A pack of mobsters, power crazed. Too much wealth oft brings malaise. Groomed each one, the chosen few, mission poison in all they do. To destroy all countries, an inside job. A cult, no doubt. Watch freedoms rob. A sickness deep inside each vein. The weffy lot. Each one insane. So thank you very much, Patrizia. Brilliant. I think sums it up quite nicely. And so we finish up with The Occult Experience, 1985 documentary, which I'll put a link up to on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, including the full interview with Nick Georges on Palestine Action as well up there on What is Satanism?
Now, if a Christian said to you, you were just really worshipping yourself, what would you say?
In a sense, they would be right. It is a form of self-worship. The only thing that keeps it from being totally that is that there is this sentient being, which is the Prince of Darkness, or Set, or Satan on a more primitive level. But it is a relationship of mutual respect rather than worship in the popular sense of the word. Yes, we regard ourselves very highly because we feel we are superior beings in a sense that we're not just little robots going around punching our time clocks, getting up, going to sleep, and that's our existence. There's much more to it than that, and we feel that we are gaining the knowledge of that deeper universe.
Anybody who attempts to explore Satanism needs to be strongly advised against it. Satan himself masquerades as an angel of light. The very nature of Satan is such that he is a liar and that he endeavors to convey something which is not true. And I think people who are deceived into being caught up in that are placing themselves in a very dangerous position. And my strong advice would be cut with it immediately.
Fascinating, I thought, from The Occult Experience, 1985 documentary. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and also, of course, to former lecturer in international relations, retired he is, in fact, Ron Mandel, and, of course, to sound engineer Dave Bazenko, to keeping all these little things working amazingly. Thanks, Dave. You can download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. and follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. Do please send me interviews or share them on there and story tips via Not the BCFM Politics Show page, where you'll also find the podcast, which gets uploaded around about 11 o'clock in the evening. Full-length interviews, story links, comment page, and our email addresses. You can subscribe to my weekly newsletter and even donate at This Week. It's all there at thisweekoneword.org.uk. We've been streaming live from PRSC Arts Centre in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream. That's the web address you need to go straight to the stream. If you ever want to do that, talkradio.org.uk. Also at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey. And live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast us, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show at 5 o'clock next Friday. I hope to have blown my nose enough times and be talking about kind of in slightly more normal voice. By then, God bless, and don't let the satanic banksters get you down. We'll be right back.
and no education to develop such a sense. Consolidated, appealing to the people of Britain. Don't support the fascist war started by the U.S. against a poor third world country just to divert attention away from the war they conduct against their own people every single day. Our politicians and entertainers continue to lie to us repeatedly.
Don't believe the hype.
Well, they certainly don't hedge their bets. I urge you to try and track down their recordings, if you've not already done so, and give them a serious listen. That's Consolidated, the last from them tonight, obviously. America Number One is the title of it.
In peace, let us pray to the Lord. Almighty God, in Christ you make all things new. Transform the poverty of our nature by the riches of your grace. And in the renewal of our lives, make known your heavenly glory, through Jesus Christ our Lord.
Amen.
O God, who have commanded us to listen to your beloved Son, be pleased, we pray, to nourish us inwardly by your word, that with spiritual sight made pure, we may rejoice to behold your glory, through our Lord Jesus Christ your Son, who lives and reigns with you in the unity of the Holy Spirit, God for ever and ever.
Amen.
Lord God, just and true, you make your salvation known in the sight of the nations. Tune the song of our hearts to the music of creation, as you come among us to judge the earth, through our Saviour, Jesus Christ.
Amen.
Kindle in our hearts, O God, the flame of love which never ceases, that it may burn in us, giving light to others. May we shine forever in your temple, set on fire with your eternal light, even your Son, Jesus Christ, our Saviour and our Redeemer. O God, our protector, by whose mercy the world turns safely into darkness and returns again to light, we give into your hands our unfinished tasks, our unsolved problems, and our unfulfilled hopes, for you alone are our sure defence and bring us lasting peace in Jesus Christ our Lord.
Amen.
We join our prayers with those of the Blessed Virgin Mary, St. John the Baptist, and all the saints and martyrs, commending to the Lord all those who have died in the faith of Christ. In fellowship with them and one another, we say the grace. The grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, and the love of God, and the fellowship of the Holy Spirit, be with us all evermore. Amen.